And comes out, work with it, get the answers, and then we'll go forward.
I'll tell you what I would like, okay? I would like a commitment on the part of the city that you're willing to work with the county government to address these right away and other issues, and that if, and ultimately, if there's an associated expense, that you are willing to do some a cost sharing with that expense. I'm not saying exactly, you know, how much.
Well, I don't want to build that fence. I mean, if there's an expense for the city attorney to do something to stop this, that's one thing. But I don't want to build that fence. I think it's going to be as ugly as the junk, frankly.
Okay.
And then how do you maintain it? How do you keep it looking good? What if he paints it purple? What are we going to do then? I mean,
well, way back when the order said that they would repair the fence and they would maintain the fence. It's in writing. It's in an order, court order, of some sort. And they haven't done that. Scott, I'm willing to go along with some kind of agreement. Personally, I'm talking myself. With some kind of agreement that says those words without the mention of money. We've got to get answers to questions before we can talk money, as far as I'm concerned. Now, what we could do, since y'all are inclined to pay $50,000, you could go ahead and work on one side of it, and we'll see how that works out. And then if we like it, we can come and do the other side.
The county has given its best faith effort to address a problem that is an eyesore for both the city and the county for 25 years. We'll just leave it at that.
What about the Municipal Association, Mr. Mayor? The county doesn't belong to the Municipal Association,
They've got their own.
But what about our Municipal Association and our Municipal Association attorney? I wonder if they have had any experience with cities frustrated by this same sort of thing.
I've not heard it mentioned in 8 years.
No, I haven't either, but I just...
It gets back to the legal aspect of this thing, I think, that it seems to be tied into a legal question. And that's understood. I mean, I understand that. But all I'm looking for are some answers on a couple of key questions to know just how far we can go with this thing. And it all gets back to we built a pretty fence for X number of dollars, but they can still put their trucks out there in front. As long as they don't leave them permanently, whatever that means. I mean, can you just visualize that now? And a citizen saying, boy, good deal, guys. You spent $50,000 here. You got all these trucks out here. That was the same. We had trucks out there before you spent $50,000. I just think we need some answers, and I don't know why. In public safety, why aren't they tagging the vehicles? Why can't we get an answer on that? These are basic questions, I think. I'll call up there myself tomorrow and ask some questions. Maybe they won't tell me. But I'll sure call and see if I can get in touch with the head person. They've got a new man up there.
Mr. Mayor, I'll offer this. I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but council can decide. If you would like to go into the legal issues a little more in depth, council could go into executive session and we could discuss those issues. If you would like to do that, we can do that. I believe it would be appropriate for you to get legal advice in executive session regarding proposed resolution or agreement with the county. And we could go. We could talk about that right now if you wanted to.
Well, we've got an executive session coming up anyway.
Right. If it's scheduled for, that's scheduled for a different matter.
But yes, it is. But can't we combine matters?
Sure.
Can't we take and personal matters?
Sure. Sure.
And to get advice on legal matter.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Scott, thank you. Thank you for your leadership here in trying to get something done. I just think, you know how I think. I appreciate you. I appreciate what you've done. And Jim, thank you for your guidance, too. And
I don't know if you need me to stay around for anything. If you don't, it's fine.
I don't think we're going to. We're not going. I don't think we're going to do anything.
No, I meant just in case there's any legal issue that you want my input on through Gary. But I'm just saying that. I'm telling you that
I can address it.
Okay, he thinks he can address it. So I guess we don't need you, Jim.
That's okay.
Hate to put it that way, but
I'm not going home.
We need you. We need you, but
I don't know how long we're going to be here.
Okay. Okay, let's see, where did we, I had some remarks, didn't I?
Yes.
I'll make them very I guess it was our last meeting that Richard Pierce had put together a letter for us for the 175th anniversary and asked council to, you know, I gave a rundown as to a format that we could have quarters, you know, and have various events during each quarter and have separate committees that would determine some of those events within a quarter. But we were looking for some names of people who you might want on the steering committee. We've got a list of names that we've kind of put together, but we were looking for maybe some input to make sure we don't miss somebody that you think ought to be on the steering committee to help form this whole plan. So if you would give us some names sometimes, Richard, or me, or Roger, because we're in the process of putting together that list now, and we even talked in terms of maybe having a steering committee set by the end of the year, perhaps, or at least early in January.
Is there going to be a budget for that?
Yeah. And that's a question that would the steering committee would help. There is some money that will be in the budget a little bit, but we thought we'd get sponsorships, Jane, and that kind of thing. And okay, the other one I was thinking about, we haven't had a review of our emergency procedures lately. And I think that might be a good thing to have, maybe early January. All of us sit down as if we had an emergency, you know, in public safety building and go through procedures. What would we do? What ifs? And that
it's
kind of
been a couple of years.
We've done it before. And
2 years.
I'd like to do it again. I know.
Do we have an emergency plan?
Oh, yeah.
It's a big book.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And suggestion with at our awards luncheon. What do you think of this idea? You know, the Golden Harvest and various organizations are asking for food, and they're not having enough. They're having twice as many people coming as they have food. Would it be wrong for us to maybe ask each employee if they wanted to bring a canned goods or two? And think of all the food we could collect there. We're doing that in our character group that we meet once a month. We're doing that in December. And I noticed that schools, you know, are gathering canned goods for Golden Harvest. But they're suffering for the lack of food to give to people that need it. Would that be out of line? I think that would be a service that the city could do for the Golden Harvest and for the people that are going to get the food. What do you think?
Looking at me or looking at council? Certainly we could ask.
You have a problem? Anybody have a problem?
Nope, not at all.
I would think that our employees wouldn't mind bringing it. We could have a couple of, you know, barrels there. We could put the cans in, a box or something.
I think it's a great idea, Mr. Mayor, you know, especially if it's just done on a voluntary basis. And
anybody wants to, you know, bring a can of food, a can of one or two, three, whatever. Okay, is that it? Is that all I had? I think that's all I had. Do we have, no, it's not either. I just, real quickly. You know the Red Cross building that Christ Central has. If you didn't get a chance to go over there tonight, you won't believe your eyes when you go up walk in that building. They have done an amazing thing in that building. It looks great.
Is it open every day?
Yeah.
Yes.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, we got an invitation. I hope we all got one.
Yeah, I was out of town, unfortunately.
But they presented a certificate of appreciation. We got here, God's visible presence on earth, to the city of Aiken, presented to those who give unselfishly of their best on behalf of mission ministry. And it's signed by Barbara Franklin. She's the president of Christ Central Missions Division. And, you know, they have a lot of missions in South Carolina, and they've got two overseas. I think one's in Nepal. And there's another one. They're starting a college. They're doing a lot of good things for a lot of folks. And here's a print that Morrison, I think it's Sherry Morrison. You ever heard of Sherry? It's a pencil or pen print, a drawing that she did of the building. And she wanted us to have that, the city to have that. So those two things.
And that's why we got that note paper.
Yeah, like she was kind enough to leave us with some notes.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
We got the notes, everybody.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, do we have a motion and a second to go into executive session for personal?
So moved.
Personnel issue and also the legal advice.
The resolution authorizing.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Okay. Okay, passes unanimously. All right.
We were asking who made the motion.
Who made the motion?
I did.
Leslie did.
Leslie seconded. And you seconded. Okay.
Thank you.
It's good then if you two did it.
Oh my goodness. First time I got
it. Who are we missing? Oh, we're not missing anybody. Okay, we're back in the session, City Council. We've just come out of our executive session where we're talking about personnel matter, and it involved our city manager and his review for the year. And we feel like as a council he's done a very good job and continues to within our budget that to do those things with his staff that means that we have relatively good standing with our budget and no immediate real concerns yet. And we appreciate all the other things that he does as well. So, Council, I'd like to have a motion, if I might, in a second. And let's have the motion state what we agreed as a council to give our city manager for the year for as a salary increase. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to recommend that we give a 2% merit increase to our city manager's salary.
Should we include the allowance?
Okay, and the car allowance?
And like also to increase the car allowance to the average of $750.
Okay. Do we have a second? Any discussion on that? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? It passes unanimously with Beverly Clyburn wasn't able to be with us this evening. So, Mr. City Manager, we thank you for your efforts as usual. And it's a joy to work with you. I appreciate you very much and all that you do for our city and helping us to make the right decisions by the information you give us, you and your staff. So we hope you're pleased with that.
And I just want to say special thanks as a rookie councilman. You've been very kind in spending a lot of time and having a lot of meetings to help me get along, so I really appreciate that. And I've learned in the year I've been on the council to have the highest respect for your performance and your dedication. The city is very fortunate to have you on board.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor, before we adjourn, you want to let Sarah know who moved to come out of executive session and who seconded it?
Yeah.
I moved.
Okay, Dick Smith made the motion. Don Wells seconded it, and it was unanimous to come out of executive session. Thank you, Lexi, for reminding me of that. Okay, this concludes our meeting this evening.
Yeah.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Aiken City Council meeting, November 24th, 2008. We're very pleased that you're here with us, and we appreciate that very much. And as we go through our agenda, if you have anything you'd like to say, just let us know. Just raise your hand, any comments and what have you, as we talk about our items. And as we get started, if you would, please stand with us for our prayer and our pledge.
Let us pray. O Lord, we give you thanks for the love and caring you so graciously bestow upon us
especially in time of stress and in time when life holds little joy. We call upon you in times of anguish and fear, and you sustain us and hold us up. Continue to be our refuge and strength during this day. Bless our nation, president and president-elect, and their financial teams as they deal with the several crises in our country. Bless to our governor and all leaders, including members of this council. Protect our defenders of freedom as they protect us. We pray in the name of the Lord. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let's see, we have...
Are there any additions or deletions necessary for our agenda this evening?
Mr. Mayor, I had asked that the Highway 19 that was MLK designated, there be a sign posted for that. Mr. Winfield, who's been coming sitting on that seat, front seat, has a big interest and has been working that for some time and hoping that we would call upon him to make a few comments, but I told him he needed to be on the agenda.
Well, certainly.
So I'd like, if he comes, I'd like to add that to the agenda just for discussion tonight. And
okay, excuse me. Excuse me for that. Well, we'll make that the third item under petitions and requests. Mr. Winfield? Okay, anything else?
Mr. Mayor, I would like to add to the agenda tonight the question of a privacy fence on Route 1 along the junkyard property, as it's known as.
Okay, all right. We'll make that number 4 then. And I've got a couple of things I want to mention at the end of the meeting. So why don't we'll make mine
remarks.
Make mine 5, and I'll just say remarks. Is that okay? None of them are going to take any time, really. Much time, that is. One of them's on our 175th anniversary, and got a couple other things here just to mention. Anything else? If not, do we have a motion in the second then?
So moved.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of the agenda? Approval? Okay, passes unanimously. Next item is the minutes. Consideration of the minutes of the regular meeting of November 10th, 2008.
Move for approval, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. I'll second it. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimous. Next item is presentation. We have many, as you know, we have many volunteer committees in the city that help us look into various things and help us to do a better job. And we like to recognize those board members and commission members when they leave their respective committees. And so we have several tonight that I want to make presentations to. We have a total, I think, of 21. Don't know that all 21 will be here. I don't think so. But I'm going to go down to that mic and call out names. And if you're here, please come over and accept your thanks with their certificate. Okay. Most of these, or at least a majority of these, will be somewhat old because, very honestly, we didn't keep up with some of them, and we're trying to catch up. But please don't let that mean to you, if you're here, that we don't appreciate your work any more than that. We do. We appreciate the work of all our committee members, and I've said earlier, I'll just repeat quickly, that we couldn't do our job well if we didn't have the advice and the support from our, I think we have 13 different committees that help us in our city. I'm going to go down here, these may be mixed up, so I'm just going to take them as I see them here. Sid Ballantyne is the first person. I don't see Sid here. Sid worked on the Building Code Board of Appeals. Jerry Bishop, Building Code of Appeals. Brunson Cromer, also the Building Code of Appeals. Ozzie Lloyd was the Community Development Committee. Doris Johnson was Community Development Committee. Ed Brohl was the Community Development Committee. Robert Faulkner, Community Development Committee. Now, obviously, these are different years, because if they weren't, you'd think we're getting rid of the whole committee, or the whole committee retired, but they are different years. I'm just not reading the years for the sake of a little bit of time here. William McGee, Community Development Committee. Thomas Lyles, Community Development Committee. S.J. Patanini, Community Development Committee.
I'll take his, Mr. Mayor.
Huh?
I'll take his.
Okay. Fine. Dick DeWar, will you take his also? Community Development Committee.
Somebody had to show up.
Dick served on it from October 04 to September 06. Big thank you for this service and also your city council service, of course. Jim, oh my goodness. Is that Dates or Bates?
Yates.
Or what?
Yates.
Gates?
Yates.
Why?
Yates.
Yates. Yates.
Thank you. Thank you. The Environmental Committee. Is Jim here? No. Dr. Gene Eitzen. He was on the Environmental Committee. And Dr. William Meehan, he was on the General Aviation Committee. Mark Gibbons, General Aviation Committee. Ronnie Bolton, General Aviation Commission. Deborah Brooks, the Housing Authority for the City of Aiken. Robert Stack, the Housing Authority for the City of Aiken. Robert McCartney, Park Commission. Lee Poe, I know Lee's here, Park Commission. Lee served from October 96 to January of 06. And last but not last, John Gladden, Environmental Committee. John here? Yes. John served from November 95 to June 08. John, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the list we have. And I hope that gives you some idea of some of the committees that we have. And I wanted to read all of these names, because every one of them was so important. Even though they weren't here, they served, and they're very important to us. Thank you. The second item under old business is a second reading public hearing of an ordinance amending the city code adopting flood damage prevention ordinance. I'm sorry. Before we go to that item, I'm sorry, I have some myself. Does anyone else have nominations for the board? Okay. What did I do? Skip right over that? I certainly did. Excuse me. This is appointments to boards and commissions. Mr. LeDuc, please.
Yes, sir. We have several appointments to be made tonight. Councilmember Dewar would like to appoint Patricia Andringa to the Arts Commission to replace Mary Ellen Krippner. Councilmember Smith would like to have John Brookshire appointed to the Recreation Commission to replace John Graytop. And Ronald Della Mora to the Environmental Committee. Councilmember Wells would like to reappoint Henry Krippner to the Board of Zoning Appeals. And Councilwoman Waters would like to reappoint Judy Turner to the Board of Zoning Appeals. Board of Zoning Appeals and Wilkinsburg to the Planning Commission. Those are the seven appointments.
Okay. Ms. Roger.
I'm sorry.
Liz Stewart to the Planning Commission.
And Liz Stewart to the Planning Commission. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second?
So moved. Second.
Okay, second. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay, passes unanimously.
Mr. Mayor, I have recommendation for a reappointment, and that would be for John Burkhalter to the Park Commission, please.
And I have two reappointments, if you will. Ed Giobi to the Planning Commission and Don Broderick to the Design Review Committee.
Okay. Anyone else? I have four. Nancy Dukes to the Board of Zoning Appeals. These are reappointments. Boarding Zone of Appeals. Eugene McKee, Community Development Committee. Mark Hudgens, Environmental Committee. And McDonald Law, Design Review Board. Okay, these will be on our agenda next meeting and for consideration. Now, item two. Second reading and public hearing of an ordinance amending the city code adopting flood damage prevention ordinance. Mr. LeDuc.
Yes, sir. This is an ordinance to amend the Aiken City Code to establish a new section 45-1 so as to continue to apply the Federal Emergency Management Agency flood insurance rate map to all existing as well as annexed properties to be within the Aiken City limits. This is just some language and ordinance that will put us in compliance with FEMA and the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. It's a requirement that the state and the federal government has so that we can protect the assets by allowing property owners to obtain flood insurance. This is the second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to amend the Aiken City Code to allow homeowners to continue to apply for Federal Emergency Management Agency flood insurance.
Okay, thank you, sir. This is a second reading public hearing of this ordinance, and if there's anyone in the audience who would like to comment on this issue, you may do so. If not, it's back to City Council for consideration.
Mr. Mayor, I move we approve this ordinance adopting the flood damage prevention ordinance.
Okay.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
We have a second. Okay, any discussion? If not, show hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Under new business, first reading of an ordinance accepting the fiscal year 2007-2008 audited financial statements. Mr. LeDuc, please.
Yes, I'll read this by the title. It's an ordinance accepting the fiscal year 2007-2008 audit financial statements and authorizing the variances to the fiscal year 2007-2008 budget ordinance. We've been using the firm of Elliott Davis for the last several years, and they're here tonight. What I'd like to do is call up Kim Abney, our assistant finance director, who will introduce Lori Smith and say anything she would like to about the audit we have, which was a good audit this year, with few, if any, comments on it whatsoever. Kim?
Good evening. My name is Kim Abney. Anita could not be here tonight. She asked me to come and introduce Lori Smith, who will give you our report on our audit.
Thank you, Kim.
It's a pleasure to be with y'all tonight. We have completed your annual audit for the year ended June 30, 2008, and I am here on behalf of Elliott Davis. I was the shareholder in charge of your audit engagement. The senior manager, Dan Mullinax, could not be with us tonight because he's headed back to Maryland for the holidays. So I'm going to briefly highlight three documents that we have here tonight and remind you that anytime you have any questions about the audit process or about any of the financial information, feel free to contact us. Kim has our emails and our 800 numbers, and we'd be glad to talk with you about any of the documents here or about what's going on in the accounting profession in general. First off, I want to bring your attention to the big document that you have with the blue cover. As your independent certified public accountants and doing your audit, we have issued a what we call an unqualified opinion or a clean opinion on your financial statements for the year ended. In this document on page 7, you've seen these in the past. There's some nice pie charts that look at the operations of the city as a whole on a government-wide basis, which includes all your governmental funds and your business-type funds. You'll see on the revenue at the top, your major concentration as far as largest amount by category of revenue sources is in your charges for services related primarily to your enterprise funds and some of your services that you charge for within your governmental funds. Second largest source by percent is, of course, property taxes. Those two comprise the majority, by far, of the revenue source. Under your expenses, of course, the cost to provide that enterprise water and sewer operations is your largest expenditure to the total expenditures by function, right at 30%, with public safety at 26% being the second primary use of your expenditures. I'm going to move you to page 33. This is a note disclosure related to deposits and investments. And one of the things that's important to note is that we ended the year with in cash or deposits and investments right at $46 million. Now, that includes fiduciary funds and your pension investment funds. That's about 18% of your total assets when you just look at your governmental and your enterprise funds. So a large concentration of your assets are in cash and deposits. During the course of the audit, we test to make sure that what we have as far as investments are legally authorized by state law. We had no issues with compliance with state law as it related to what you were invested in. We also test for deposits with financial institutions in excess of the FDIC insurance limit to make sure that you don't have any deposits that are at risk without assets of the corresponding financial institution being pledged to secure those. Found that by law that all your deposits were collateralized, so no compliance issue related to your deposits held. This year, we also looked at your investments in recognition of what was going on around us in our economy as we closed your audit in October. We looked at your investments to make sure that any fluctuations in your investments as of September 30, 2008 were market fluctuations and not something that you needed to be concerned about. We found everything to be attributable to just mere market fluctuations and no investments that you needed to be concerned about. One of the other handouts I've got here is some good small handout, but financial highlights. You'll see the first two graphs relate to your cash and short-term investments, both general fund and cash investments as a whole on a government-wide basis. What they show from 2002 to 2008 is your liquidity position is good, pretty consistent for the past 5 years, not a lot of fluctuations in cash and investments or liquidity. It also shows that last chart that your operating cash reserves are within the recommended level by GFOA of the 3 to 6 months range. So very good management of your cash and investments. Looking further into your big report on page 37, you'll see a note called capital assets. This note on page 37 and 38 gives you what happened with our capital assets during the course of the audit period. Now, I will remind you that 77% of your assets are what we consider capital assets. The building we're in, your infrastructure, your water systems related to your enterprise funds, your equipment. During the year, you'll see we added about $6.3 million in improvements or additional capital assets. Now, as these assets are being depleted, it's always important that we continue to replace those assets at a level that's, you know, larger than what we're consuming. And you'll see that in this note at the end, we were 3.8. So our capital asset additions less our depreciation or utilization of those assets, we're in a very positive position. Going to move you to the last note disclosure on page 39 and 40. This relates to your liabilities, and the city does have very low debt. Your only bonds really are two revenue bonds that are outstanding, and you'll see those noted on page 39 with their debt maturities and on page 40. The last schedule I want you to refer to is page 48. 48 is your recap of your general fund budget, what we budgeted for revenues and expenses, and what we actually ended up with revenues and expenditures for the year. What you'll see is positive budget variances both on your revenues, collected more than we budgeted, and on our expenditures, we expended less than we budgeted, which is a very positive from a fiscal management standpoint. You'll see that our revenues on
question with regard to the part of positive variances, do they also reflect in any way on the ability to budget? In other words, we didn't correctly anticipate the revenues that were coming in.
I think the fact that that column says original and final budget, I mean, a budget is a tool. You set your best estimate there, and you revise it if it becomes materially different during the course of the year. You'll see your original and final budget were the same. So I think your team did a very good job of anticipating your revenues and your expenditures for the year and controlling those. So,
we are, what, about 6 or 7% high? 1.8 out of 24.
We received about 8% higher in revenue, and we had our expenditures were about 2% higher.
Okay.
So a net about 6%.
Yeah. Your revenue budget, really, you were conservative on budgeting your revenues. You're right. Your variance is a little higher there on a relative dollar basis. Your expenditures almost flat, like you say. Very, very small difference between what you budgeted and what you expended, but you expended a little less.
Okay. Thank you.
Good question, though. If you look at your revenues, actual revenues and expenditures on general fund, you'll see took in about 26.4, expended about the same. So we ended up with about $115,000 increase in general fund, which is very flat for the amount of dollars you're dealing with there if you're on a comparison basis. Your other handout, the chart here on that second page, you'll see there's a little comparison here of our general fund unreserved fund balance to operating expenses. That also is within the range of where you want that to be when you look at your general fund unreserved. We're right at 45%. We're at 49% the prior year. Very much where you want to maintain your general fund equity balance. Direct you to very last part of this report, page 105. This is the second opinion Elliott Davis issued in regards to your audit of the financial statements. This is what we call our report on internal control over financial reporting and compliance with state law. This report says that we had no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies that were encountered during the testing related to your internal control, and we had no instances of noncompliance with laws and regs that were uncovered during the audit. This year, you did not have enough federal expenditures to be subject to single audit, so there was no single audit opinion in this report. In the past, you have had single audit. You may end up with a single audit again next year on your federal expenditures.
Lori, would you explain that, the single audit?
You are required, if you expend more than $500,000 in federal funds during the course of your year end, to be subject to a single audit, where we would test those federal funds that were expended in agreement with what the grant documents provided for.
Okay, thank you.
I've got another blue report that's it's new this year. It's very small. It's the one I handed out probably about 10 minutes ago. We were required to implement some new audit standards during the course of this audit engagement and to generate this report. This report is very much a non-traditional report. It really has no numbers in it like your financial statements, but it's a reminder of what our responsibility is as your audit firm. And just as a reminder, it's management and elected officials' responsibility for the financial statements. Our responsibility as your external audit firm is to audit those financial statements and the underlying information to make sure that we have applied generally accepted accounting principles and governmental auditing standards. And looking at your financial statements, there are a couple estimates in there, depreciation being the biggest one, how long our capital assets are really going to last. So that's just a reminder. During the course of the audit, we had no what we considered disagreements with management or difficulties encountered during the audit. We have enclosed in here our audit planning letter, just for your information, our audit engagement letter, and our management rep letter in the back. And last but not least, we are required to talk to you a little bit about new accounting standards. And I think I've done this in the past, but not in a written form. But on page one of this little report, you'll see there's four new standards. The biggest one is your accounting for other post-employment retirement benefits that I know y'all have already started funding. We've already funded, and you can see in the first report we looked at, about $586,000 for that liability. That will be implemented during your course of your audit for June 30, 2009. And you will be recording a liability related to those benefits, primarily health insurance that you're offering for those retired employees.
Are you satisfied with the GASB 45 accounting?
Yes, I have looked at your information, and a lot of this information is actuarial based, so these are very much estimates. As time goes on, I think you will see that history build a little bit, and those actuarial calculations, when they're updated, hopefully that liability will go down a little.
So, do you have a sense of how many city staff are nearing retirement so that you can reasonably project an anticipated use of this account?
Well, this standard requires you to use an actuarial is to use another firm, an actuary, to actually do these calculations. These calculations are very involved, and they do scope your employees by age, by gender, and they look at your existing policy of what you're going to provide. So,
but this is relatively new, is it not?
Yes, it is.
So we couldn't have it fully funded from the get-go. And I think it's only, I mean, we've talked about this.
The standard has not even gone into effect yet. We're pre-paying into it, anticipating the new standard. Our biggest liability gap is we had a policy and still have a policy that you could retire at age 55, and therefore you could be getting health benefits from us till age 65, at which point our liabilities are greatly reduced due to the fact that there is other health insurance that we've become secondary to. We approved, I want to say about 3 years ago, Council approved changing the time that health benefits could be accrued by new employees. So every new employee in the past 3 years has to wait till 65 before they can start using our health insurance, which therefore means that over the next 30 years, let's say, the length of employment of an individual, our liabilities will be reduced almost down to nothing, because then we become secondary to everybody. But until that time happens, we have seen just in the fact that in the last 5 to 6 years, statistically, in the United States, over half those that are employed will seek new employment. So, and we've seen that true in looking at our numbers, that this work staff we had 5 years ago, there's been a 50% change in the individuals. So our gap is narrowing on that.
I'm not sure how that plays. If somebody retires after the age of 55 and then goes to work for someone else, we still are on the hook for their retirement medical benefits. And I mean, GASB 45 is only for the like medical.
That is correct.
Yeah, but we would still pay their medical benefits even beyond that age if they went to work for someone else, wouldn't they? Wouldn't we?
Assuming they don't have health insurance at that other location.
Okay, but are you satisfied that we're okay with this? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're still on our health insurance. In other words, they're covered for all their claims. It's just that we have to contribute more towards that.
Yes.
This is a very, very complex accounting standard as you rank them. I think time will tell how the numbers play out, because they are very much estimates to begin with. Phase one governments were required to implement this standard for June 30, 2008. Those are your larger governments. I will tell you that the school districts and the college and universities in the state come under the state of South Carolina, so they didn't have to deal with this. Their numbers are rolling up in the state's report. Counties, cities, special purpose districts had to deal with it just like y'all had to. Get your own numbers, analyze it. Most of our governmental entity clients have revised their policy, most of them on a go-forward basis, not changing what they've offered existing employees, but trying to change it as it relates to new employees. We have seen probably our special purpose districts be able to maybe try to really look at fully funding it. Our counties have struggled with how they're going to fund it. And some of our phase one counties that have implemented for June 30, 2008 left it unfunded the first year and still looking for ways to find a funding source.
It's not required by law that you fund this. It just means if you don't fund it, then if you want to go out for bonds, you could be in have difficulty.
Well, and I think almost every municipal association meeting we go to, there's usually some kind of session on GASB 45 to make sure you stay out of trouble. So,
yeah, it's probably going to be the hot topic for the next 2 years.
I mean, is it appropriate to ask you if you think we're comfortable with this? I mean, that's why we hire you, is
yes.
it not?
Yeah, I think y'all have handled it in a very good, forward-looking way compared to what I've seen on some of our governmental clients.
Okay.
Other standards, not as significant, relate to pollution and remediation liabilities. That's a new one that you'll have to implement next year. I really don't see it impacting y'all. I'll deal more with your management team about it to make sure we're ready. Some others that are out there, a year out, 2010, intangible assets and derivative instruments, don't see that having a major impact on you either. We are required to tell you about those new accounting standards. So. That was kind of what I had highlighted. I'll be glad to take any other questions.
I have a few.
Okay, good.
And I may have some more when you come back. I'm sorry I didn't get to study this in great detail. Are you also satisfied with the independence of your hiring process? As I understand it, it's the council that's supposed to hire you. And in your process, are you satisfied that there's a hands-off element on the part of city staff in selecting you?
Right. We are engaged by City Council and from an independent standpoint, and we are required by our professional standards to make sure that all our audit team is independent in relation to any type of transactions that they would have with the city or any type of, say, entity that they might be a part of, a closely held business that would have transactions with the city. And we had no issues there at all from an independent standpoint.
Okay, and on page 7, where you where you show the revenues and the expenses, it may be too late this year, but I would love to have seen the trend on those different categories in the last 4 or 5 years. If maybe you could file that away for next year, or if you could have it when you come back in a couple of weeks when we do the second reading.
Yeah, we could actually pull. I think this part has been in your report for the past, 3 years I've been involved, so we could clearly pull that. Kim is in the process of putting together what we call your comprehensive annual financial report that has a lot of graphs and statistical tables in the back, and it could be that we could implement some of those trends into those tables in the future,
okay.
too. But I'll be glad to get you that.
And my next comment concerns the item on page 11, where I guess we're fortunate as I look at our financial situation. Roger's done a great job with the budgeting, and we're not in financial straits at this point, but we're in a whole new world when it comes to finance, as we can see from looking at the TV every day. We're reflecting an unemployment rate, I think you indicated here, 5.4%, which is lower than the state and the national. The world can change significantly. Are you comfortable? This ended June 30th?
That's correct.
Okay. So it wouldn't be fair to ask you about any economic factors after that.
I can give you the website where they have this on a monthly basis. I can send you that site. I think those numbers have changed a little. We do look at subsequent events. We issued your audit. You can see from our opinion letter, October the 8th is when we issued you this audit report. But you are trending a little up, but I still think Aiken is trending less than the state and probably less than a national average still.
But the way we do our finance is almost it's very close to a pay-as-you-go system, so that's good, and I think for our part keeps us out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
I wrote down page 104. Oh, on page 104, where you talk about the fines and so forth, I just have a question. Maybe it should go to Roger as opposed to you, but we collect fines, we don't keep them, and they don't go to the state treasurer. What happens to them?
By state law, approximately half the money that we get in fines goes to the state, and they have a long litany of things that they use for that, anywhere from paying for the various courts to paying for the jails to paying for public safety.
But the first one, Roger, it says court fines. We collected $514,000, and retaining was a negative figure, so is it correct that we don't keep them?
I think the court fines retained by the city would mean primarily you're required to file a monthly report with the state on the magistrate and clerk of court fines and your victim's services fines. And about probably 7 years ago, the state said, we want you to add the schedule to the audit. And that first line where it says retained by the city, those are primarily your speeding traffic ticket fines, where if somebody's driving through the city and gets stopped and fined, you get to keep all of those fines.
If you see the next line where it talks about the assessments,
mm-hmm.
and how very little bit of it's retained by the city and most of it goes to the state. And so when you talk about a traffic ticket or anything else, there's fines and then there's the assessments mm-hmm. that go along with it.
Well, the traffic tickets, I thought half of the ticket revenue went to the state.
Right. And if you look at these numbers, it's very close. $514,000 plus the $58,000, that's $572,000. We capped and $613,000 went to the state.
Oh, I see. Okay. I just didn't know how to read the chart then. Okay. Thank you. And do you make any assessment, any judgments on our budget after we approve it, or either from last year or this year? Is that part of your process to look at?
Your budget is required for your general fund and any major special revenue funds to be a part of your report, but it's not a part that we're required to audit.
Okay.
It goes behind the notes.
Okay, thank you. I'll have more questions in a few weeks.
Okay.
Typically, we don't have Lori come back, but if you want, we can. If you have questions or if you want to give them to us, we could get the answers if Anita does not know them. Anita should be back the next meeting, and typically Anita or Kim can probably answer the questions. But again, if there's something specific.
Well, it's coming back for second reading. I'm fine. I don't need Elliot Davis. I mean, I just apologize. I did get a chance to go through it as much as I'd like to. So,
like I say, we are available. Should you want to, they want to email us something, you know.
What I'd like you to just take one last look at, and that's these little graphs that they've given us on page 2 at the very top. To me, one of the most important indications of where we're at, in 2002, we had about $6 million in unreserved fund balance, and we've almost doubled that in the last 6 years. That's, in many ways, a very critical number. Although that $12 million is allocated to various things, mainly towards repairs of these buildings and vehicles and computer replacement, it is money that is available. If we get into a catastrophic problem, or in the past when councils wanted to do a project, and instead of us going out for bonds, we borrowed internally, that $12 million is there, even though we have it allocated for projects that we think we want to do in the future. It has given us the opportunity to go ahead and do a number of things without having to go to the bond market. And that's why you see it's almost unheard of a city of our size not to have the debt. And the only debt you have is with the water and sewer. And that'll be paid off in 6 years. We have not had general fund debt for probably 5 or 6 years. It's allowed us not to have to go ahead and raise the taxes for 20 years and to do other things as council has looked at. We feel comfortable with the $12 million, but again, just 6 years ago, we only had $6 million. At that time, it's not that we didn't feel comfortable, but it didn't allow us to do some of the things we were able to do today. So that's the one area that I really appreciate finance and others in working with to get us to this level. So that if the economy continues in a downward track and we all of a sudden start seeing revenues not coming in like we want, where we have the ability to take some of these unreserved funds and to tide us over until the economy gets back on its feet.
Now, if the economy goes down as everyone's projecting it, do you see a decrease in the 1 cent? I mean, obviously, you're going to have a decrease in the 1 cent sales tax revenue coming in. That would extend the existing program and imperil the next one?
Most of the good, you know, and if you look at what areas in the marketplace are being affected primarily, it's car purchases. We don't have any car dealerships inside the city limits. So that's an area that's being hit very hard. It's not hitting us. We do have most of the goods and services, though, for the county, where people do buy their groceries here and go to the store to get their general merchandise. The last check we received on the 1 cent sales tax, which would have carried us through, I believe it's the month of September into October, was still higher than the quarter equivalent to it a year ago.
Okay.
And as far as the 1 cent sales tax, which gives us a real good indication of the revenue coming in 2004, when the general public approved the second local option sales tax, that's to be paid off over a 7-year period of time. Right now, the revenues that are coming in since that time, it'll be paid off in less than 6 years. So, although I believe, as where I think you're going, that we're going to see some less revenue, we're not being hit nearly as hard as many others that I've talked to across the country.
Okay. Thank you.
Lori, thank you very much. We appreciate your good work with us. Kim, we appreciate you and Nita and your staff. And please tell them, from council's point of view, we sure appreciate what y'all do to help keep everything on a level and even keel there with that budget. And we're proud of the city manager, too, and what he does to keep our budget where it should be. Okay. Item 2.
Did we take a vote on that?
No, we didn't take a vote on that. Do we have a motion and a second?
Mr. Mayor, I move that we adopt or accept the audited financial statements on first reading.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Any more discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor. Passes unanimously. Item 2, reading of an ordinance to annex property at 505 Douglas Drive. Mr. LeDuc, please.
Yes, sir. I'll read this by the title. It's an ordinance to annex the corporate limits of the city of Aiken, certain property consisting of 0.42 acres of land owned by ERC Incorporated and located at 505 Douglas Drive, and is owned the same residential single-family RS-10. The owner of this property would like to come to the city so they could receive services that we provide. There's a single-family dwelling unit under construction at the site, and so it is contiguous by the opposite side of the street. And the Planning Commission voted unanimously to approve this annexation. So for City Council consideration, this is first reading of an ordinance to annex into the City of Aiken 505 Douglas Drive under the RST Zone 10 Zone.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. Do we have a motion and a second?
Mr. Mayor, I move that we approve this ordinance on first reading to annex the property at 505 Douglas Drive to the RS 10 Zone.
Second, Mr.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion? If not, show hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Item 3 is the first reading of an ordinance to amend the zoning ordinance regarding accessory buildings in the HD and RSS zones. Mr. LeDuc, please.
Yes, sir. I'm going to read this again by title only. It's an ordinance amending the zoning ordinance regarding accessory buildings in the HD and RSS zone. Several months ago, it was early this summer, Grant Larley came to City Council with a concern that in the primarily the Horse District, RSS zones, that the outparcels or the outbuildings, which need to be of a certain size to meet the needs of the community, was being restricted by the fact that just a few years ago we said the outparcel buildings could only be no larger than 50% of the size of the main building. Works very well in every area of the city except in these areas primarily where horses and horse-related activities are taking place. You sent this to the Planning Commission. They had numerous discussions concerning this, and they have come back to you with a recommendation that we maintain the ordinance that we had previously, which restricted the accessory buildings to 50% or smaller, except in the HD Horse District Zone and the Residential Single Family Stable Zone, the RSS, with those lots of being 1 acre or larger in size. So the Planning Commission unanimously approved this, and what they're proving is that all lots in the HD zone, lots in the RSS zone, in the historic overlay district, and any lot of 1 acre or more in the RSS zone outside the historic district would be exempt from paragraphs B, D, and E of 3.42, which you have a copy of in your agenda. So for your consideration tonight, this is first reading of an ordinance to amend the zoning ordinance regarding accessory buildings in the HD and RSS zone as per the attached Planning Commission memorandum.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second?
Mayor, I move that we approve this in reading the Planning Commission's recommendation. It allows more flexibility for the location, size, and accessory buildings on the property.
Okay. Do we have a second? We have a second? Okay.
I'll second.
Any discussion?
I think this does recognize how unique the Horse District is, and it does seem appropriate to me that it have rules reflecting that uniqueness and not necessarily be just everything we do in any new subdivision. And that's so I support it.
Thank you, Jane. Any other comments?
Just a question. Who then approves an accessory building, and what kind of guidance does the council provide for the approval? We're saying that the 50% is going to disappear. What's it going to be replaced with?
The 50% will disappear in these zones only.
Yes, which is essentially the Horse District.
That's correct. Everywhere else, the ordinance will stay, or the zoning ordinance will stay as is.
So in the 50%, if I could just pick a lot, that we have a lot that's 3.3 acres, first of all, which board or commission would end up dealing with that? Would it be the Design Review Board or the Board of Zoning
You're
Appeals.
You're talking about in the Horse District?
In the Horse District.
Mr. Evans?
Sign review.
I give you my opinion, but he'll tell you the facts.
I hope we get some input from the horse community on this.
Excuse me. Most of the Horse District is in the Historic District, mm-hmm. so it would go to the Design Review Board for approval. And those lots that are RSS, most of those are in the Historic District. They would go to the Design Review Board also.
So would is it appropriate for the council to set any kind of guidelines for what they should approve? Or
in effect, I think because most of the lots in HD and RSS would end up going before DRB, then it made sense just to have them have the jurisdiction over it and take counsel out of it. That was the thinking.
Well, the guidelines would be those in the design review manual.
Manual, correct.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of debate at the Planning Commission level as, you know, should it be 80%, should it be 100%, what height, how close, and to try to come up with a standard that would fit everything in a horse district with all the various needs that they may have. That's why they finally just said, well, can we come up with something that could make sense for everything? And said, let's let the design review board, which is going to be looking at the what the structure looks like anyways, let them deal with it on a case-by-case basis.
So this
council
would,
could go ahead and set guidelines if you wanted to, though.
Well, this would take the Board of Zoning Appeals out of it, then they would not be involved with accessory buildings in the horse district?
Correct, unless they needed a setback, variance.
Yeah. Right. Otherwise, okay. And they now consider it before this change. It now goes to the...
If they exceed the limit on 50% of the floor area of the main building or the height limitation, or if the accessory building is not in the rear or side yard, they have to go to BZA for a variance. And this change would do away with that. It would just be within the lap of DRB.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Any other discussion? Thank you, Ann.
Has the equine committee, they've given their input to the Planning Commission, or do we know that?
We did not ask them. Typically, that's not issues that they would get involved in. I do know that at the meeting of the Planning Commission, when they had the public meeting, I went to the work session, and there were probably at least two members of the Equine Committee that were there, several individuals that lived in the Horse District, and I was expecting they were going to have all kinds of thoughts on it, and they all just said, well, it looks good.
Okay, good.
And this is first reading, so there's an opportunity for more input the second public hearing.
Okay, anything else? If not, show of hands, please. All
anybody from the public want to speak on it?
Well, anyone from the public is certainly welcome to talk if you... I didn't see a hand. Okay, excuse me. Maybe I missed it.
I didn't see a hand.
Hello. Bernadette Clayton. I'm not a resident in the area, but I represent a lot of people in the area. The only thing that I throw out for caution is that with no regulation of some sort, that you have to look at the green space, especially in the horse district, because in order to have barns and houses and horses residing together, if you don't have adequate green space, you can run into some real difficult management issues.
Brenda, do you think that most folks that have horses understand that?
Yes and no.
Yeah. Well, you're always going to find somebody that doesn't understand something, but I would guess that most of them understand that.
Yes and no, and the only thing is that you know, there are certain situations where, like with a carriage barn, you need space for your carriage, but if you try and overbuild your barn in the horse district, you can end up some real management problems that will create neighbor problems, and so just a little caution to that.
I was talking to a member of the Planning Commission about this, and or two of them actually, and they seem to think that that is a subject that maybe they should address, is the lot coverage, and, but they felt that it should be a separate issue.
And actually, Jenny Stoker and I have talked a lot about it. You know, the covered space, you know, a permeable space on a lot is really important, especially when you're dealing with horses. I mean, there are books written about horse management on small acreage, and it's a real management issue, and those involved in the horse district and managing horses recognize that. And we have so many new people to the industry as well that, you know, think maybe it's a really great idea to buy this piece of property and then let's build this great big barn, and then you have no place to keep your horses and no place to dispose of your manure and have proper runoff so that you're not having issues with nasty odors and whatnot. So,
but now, could this not be handled on a case-by-case basis, you know, when it comes before the design review board?
I think it could, but I think your design review board has to be adequate and knowledgeable in the management of horses.
Well,
and
you know,
I know that that issue has come up where people don't necessarily understand what is required and why. And I know of one barn that this came up with, and it is somebody with carriage horses, and they needed the barn to be bigger in order to house the carriage, not necessarily the horse. Okay, so. It could, but I think you need to have like a subcommittee or somebody that then your design review board can turn to that would understand horses, barns, and management of horses on small acreage. And that's what you're dealing with horses in the city of Aiken.
You know, I don't disagree with you on what you're saying, but I just, you know, feel like that when a property is posted that, you know, it's going to come up in front of the design review board, that the neighbors would certainly, it would kind of pique their interest to find out what was going on. And if they were present here during that hearing, that, you know, these would be items that they would bring up for consideration by the DRB. And, I mean, by all means, I do think they should be brought up.
But I think also in that area, and we had a case this summer where it was being dealt with in the summer in an area where a lot of people were up north or not around or off someplace, and they missed a lot of people that weren't aware of this happening. And so depending on the timing of when something comes before a design review board, it can be totally missed by the neighbors.
It's precisely why I made the point. You're not giving any standards to the design review board. It's just whatever they think is comfortable for that particular piece of property at that particular time, and lacking input from neighbors could end up with overdevelopment of a lot, not enough room for the horses.
Well, you know, Councilman, I disagree with you on this from the standpoint that they do have design guidelines that are set forth in which they take a look at and weigh these projects. You know, I mean, I just think it would be very difficult to make a hard and fast ruling for council to make and say this is the way that it's got to be, and it fit every individual circumstance. That one size fits all, I don't think, would work with this.
Well, barring an input from someone in the horse community, I'm not inclined to go further than my comments, but we're not giving any guidance. We're taking away the 50% rule, which may be appropriate. Maybe 50% of the size of the dwelling on the lot is not appropriate. But again, if the horse community is happy with it, and I'm sure they know what we're doing, then I'll back off.
Well, you know, my what I'm saying is we have given guidelines, and that is in the design review guidelines for this area. I mean, these are guidelines that were set forth, brought forth and voted on by city council.
But there's really nothing in them about this this horse issue specifically.
You know, perhaps if this is something that is of a major concern, that we need to revisit those guidelines and add something in there.
Yeah, exactly.
That causes this to trigger their thinking.
If nothing else, suggests that or have a paragraph that instructs them to consult with this equine committee that we have, that is made up of people, we hope, that are knowledgeable, and that would be part of the process that they would be required to go through. And then maybe, I'm just thinking of at the spur of the moment, but that might give them the kind of expertise they need to make some decisions. And
I would be in favor of that, as long as, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis and, mm-hmm. and not just one size fits all.
Well, there are several things that comments that you made that protects neighbors. One is you mentioned the runoff, the odors, and if that is a problem with the city, that is a health issue. And certainly that's a different level of enforcement if someone is not caring for their property and there is odor and all the other things that comes with an impact on your neighbors. The other thing that I become concerned with is having a hard, fast rule when you've got different size lot and a cookie cutter for everybody. And so where I have a problem with is what is the best ordinance to have that would not be a cookie cutter where everybody has to conform and it's made for all that is involved. And certainly if we have someone to alert the equine community, even sending letters to those that are impacted, because it is my feeling that if a piece of property is impacted, then everybody in that area should be informed. So if we have some sort of trigger with letting the neighbors know what's going on, surely those that who are on travel get mail. The mail is going somewhere. That could be an alert or a trigger for them to say somebody has to be concerned about it, and how can I get my opinions known about what's going on?
Just from being and working in that district and handling the mail for a lot of people, the way people are notified is it's only those directly next to it, but it impacts on a broader area. And I just, the point I think needs to be addressed, and it may not be in this particular format, but I think green space ratio in the horse district is a really important part of what has to be looked at, so that you don't end up with a lot of solid covered ground that is not permeable, and then that is an important.
Well, going green is a popular phrase.
It's popular, but it's absolutely necessary when you're managing horses.
And I'm aware of that, because we're looking for as much green space as we can here to protect those areas. You raise a good point, but what is the best solution to that?
I'm
right.
It still seems to me that the most sensible way to solve this is to amend the guidelines, not put any hard and fast rules, but just make some comments about the fact that they have to use horse sense, if you will, in doing this, and
that, like the phrase,
preserve sufficient green space to ensure that they're not harming neighbors. Something like that, a very general guideline.
Bernadette, thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's a very good comment you had, and certainly it's important. And Jane, you'd mentioned it, and then I think several of us were thinking of it probably using the equine committee that we've got. We very seldom have a situation where we have to call on them. So they could certainly be available to the design review, and perhaps we ought to consider amending design review standards to include something like that. And
I might ask Bernadette if you would ask those folks. We have a second reading for this at the next scheduled meeting. If they can come to provide their input or write us to let us know what they're thinking.
Well, I have no doubt that the other folks that own horses will say the same thing. The question is whether or not a person with the horse moving into such a lot would normally know that they have to have adequate space. I think they would. However, you could always have one or two or three that don't, or someone that doesn't. But I think it could be solved by doing just that, adding the fact that the design review, when they have such a case come up, they at least discuss this with the equine committee.
What I could do is, Lucy Knowles is the chairperson of the equine committee. I'll ask her to, and we may not be able to get it before the holiday season, get them together. But normally we meet in April, May time period. We'll try to convene that committee in January and have them look at the issue in relationship to the design review board and have them come with some recommendations. And I'm sure they'll have something, and then we could bring that back to you in January, February time frame.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To kind of be a corollary to this change that you're making.
Okay. I just wonder if this was discussed in the Planning Commission meeting. Bernadette, did you happen to be at the meeting? Or?
Yes, I did go to that meeting, and it did get discussed a little bit, and it was more of an after discussion where they wanted to send it on to council, but and we thought something about it for another meeting. And there were quite a few people there. Jenny Stark was there, Andy Taylor, there were a number of people there, as well as
Leo is here from the planning committee.
Thank you. Huh?
Leo is here from the planning committee.
Who?
Leo Brooker.
Leo. Excuse me, Leo. Do you have any comments that you want to make or any thoughts on this subject?
He had stepped out when you mentioned that, Mr. Lane. I think he stepped out when you asked.
Huh?
He had stepped out of the room when you asked.
Oh, okay.
Leo Brooker, 336 Grandin Flora Circle, Aiken. When it was brought to our attention at the planning meeting, and I'll say the fact that I don't own horses, so I'm not an expert in that area, but the concern came up, the issue came up with the heating floor, the percentage that was already required, and our thoughts was, if we took out the percentage, being that we did not know what would be the best percentage wise, that in the case of the case by case situation, if that came up as far as the height of the build of say a barn is being built, that the design review board would have the guidelines, or be better at being able to regulate that in that area. But as far as the issue that I'm sorry, I didn't get her name, but
Bernadette,
it would be hard for me to really say what would be the best. Best way, a best approach to that. I would say I would probably need to relate that to someone who has more knowledge about that in the horse district.
Sure, we appreciate that. Okay. But I think if it's acceptable to council, that we could do as Roger has suggested, follow up with a design review on this, and see what their thoughts are.
The Equine Committee.
Equine Committee too, but I mean with the design review as far as making a change. Is there anything in the design review that talks about setbacks or green space at all? Relates to this subject. Is there, Ed?
And you're talking about accessory buildings?
Yeah, I'm talking about this subject we're talking about right here. Is anything in design review, because this would go to design review, as we've already said, if it's in the
I don't have them in front of me, but I mean, there is wording about the placement of buildings on property and the relationship of buildings to each other and adjacent property and that kind of thing. But, you know, we have to look back and really see what specifically is there. The commission did approach the whole issue from the beginning from an open space perspective and try to set a percentage, maximum percentage of lot coverage for all buildings. And it just got to be so complicated that they just backed away and, again, kind of put it in the lap of DRB, relying on design guidelines. And it's just one of those things that tended to be self-regulating. I mean, I think, as you alluded to, that most horse people understand the amount of open space that they need on a piece of property, and they're not going to unnecessarily overbuild. And I think that's the way the Planning Commission kind of came down and, again, just kind of gave it back to the DRB and let them decide.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Ed, about what we were discussing here about would it seem logical to put a footnote in the guidelines to say, hey, if you have an issue such as this,
It's worth looking at the guidelines to see what the wording is, and there may be a need to tighten it up. But again, I think you need to keep in mind that until three years ago, there were no restrictions on accessory buildings in this district or really in any other district. These were put in 3 years ago, and so now you're taking something away that didn't exist for a long time, and there didn't seem to be any problems that arose when there were no regulations.
Okay. Very, very good point. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Mayor, in our packet, we got the draft of the Planning Commission minutes for that, which, of course, obviously have not been approved. And they basically said, in referring to the 50% rule, that these amendments orient into typical subdivisions with detached single-family dwellings on relatively small lots. Little, if any, thought was given to the impact on the horse-oriented area, and the current regulations are too restrictive, so, which is the reason they sent it to us, apparently.
I still think we need to consult the Equine Committee. I'd like to consult them before we vote on the second reading of this thing, just to see what they think and be sure that we're not forgetting some huge some issue. And the fact of the matter is, it depends on what sort of horse activity is going on, Bernadette, does it not, too, as to how much open space you need and all that sort of thing. And rather than get into that detail by detail again, require that they discuss proposals with the Equine Committee.
Yeah. Housing requirements for the hunter versus the carriage horse versus the race horse, they all vary tremendously.
Yeah.
You could pack a lot of race horses into a small area because they don't require a lot of turnout. They don't like to turn the race horses out. Your fox hunters, they turn them out. Your carriage horses need garages for the carriages. So it does vary tremendously with each discipline. And that's the thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm. And that's another reason it makes it a little bit harder to set a set a firm percentage.
And again, once a certain type of structure has been built there, doesn't mean that a year or 2 years later someone moves and a different type of discipline goes into that area. If you want us to wait and get something from the Equine Committee, then we would delay this till sometime in January, if that's what Council would like us to do.
Is there a significant adverse impact, Ed, on doing that? Have you got anything in the mill?
Well, I see no reason why we can't pass it on first reading, and then if we need to table it get information.
All we would do would be to just hold off and just reschedule.
All I'm saying is I wouldn't bring it to Council for second reading until, and I just doubt if we're going to get the Equine Committee together before Christmas time.
Right.
There's nothing urgent about adopting it.
Okay.
Okay. Any other thoughts? We have a motion and second already. If there's nothing else to discuss, show of hands, please. Pass on the first reading. Okay. Passes unanimously. Under petitions and requests, request from Paul Sauerborn regarding landscaping at Highland Park and Highland Terrace. Mr. LaDuke, please.
Yes, several weeks ago, probably more like six weeks ago, SCE&G came in there and cut down a number of trees and shrubs in this area. Mr. Sauerborn contacted me shortly thereafter, and we told him that when this winter comes along, we would go in there and get it cleared out, and then we'd put the appropriate shrubbery and trees that would be appropriate to this corner. It is the corner. You can now see where the staircase is, concrete walkway goes up to the former Highland Park Hotel. In the past, when we looked at landscaping areas, we put special emphasis into entranceways in the city with a higher degree of landscaping than as we get into more your side streets or other areas, then our degree of landscaping becomes of a smaller amount just from the economics. I did talk to Larry Morris. He's somewhere. There he is. And they have been looking at it. So, Larry, you may want to go ahead and just say what Tom has talked about as far as landscaping that area. And then I believe Mr. Sauerborn's in the back row there. There he is.
Yes, SCE&G definitely helped us out, as the saying goes, over there cutting the trees and everything. But that corner did need some attention. It was one of our parkways that we were going to be doing some work on. It's not really a parkway. It's kind of a corner, very odd intersection right there. It's not a standard T. The two roads kind of parallel and then come together. We just finished today the majority of the clearing, where we took out some volunteer Carolina cherries and some other trash trees like that, a lot of vines, things like that that we've gotten out. We still have to grind some stumps. Part of what we do with the funding that we have each year for parkway improvements is go into parkways such as this and remove the material that is volunteer, doesn't look real good, just a lot of vines, things like that, and then come back and we'll plant trees. In the case of Hayne Avenue, we're planting oaks and other large varieties. In the case of an area like this, what Tom normally will do is put in a flowering variety of tree, a small tree. Because one thing, it's under power lines. We don't want SCE&G to come and cut down what we put in. So he would put something like that in. We would mulch the area. And then to keep the vines and everything from coming back, we do use Roundup as a rule in our parkways to keep the volunteer stuff down. So that's what we do with those. We did that with the Lancaster Parkway in that same general area a few years back. And we don't return them to a total natural state, but we return them to a low maintenance natural state, let's call it, so that we then have something much nicer to look at. It improves the vision for the traffic there, and that's one of our goals right now, is to be able to see better for the vehicles coming on that street. So that's our basic plan. Again, the clean out is almost complete except for stump grinding, and then Tom already has some trees on order. I don't know if these particular trees are here yet or not, but he will be installing some flowering varieties there, probably three or four trees in that general area, to make certain that we don't crowd them out, and then we'll mulch it.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Any questions for Larry?
Paul Sauerborn's here.
Paul? Yes, sir.
Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Sauerborn, 549 Highland Park Drive. And I did ask that I come and speak to the council. And I got to tell you that Roger LaDuke is a very good fella. I spoke with him at length about this subject, as he said. And I know Larry Morris very well. And it sounds like the undertaking by the city will be appropriate for a historic spot like this. I did bring some handouts that I can show you what happened, and I think, as Larry pointed out, SENG did the city a favor, or somebody a favor, but it started with that. And, you know, the concern I have is that what's happening at other locations? And I have to address my location, but I can always look at other locations. I've noticed some other selective clearing done along Powder House Road and other avenues that have top-notch equipment. You know, the cherry pickers go up, they do selective clearing and cutting, and it's like very prescriptive. In this case, by virtue of the pictures I showed you, it was a subcontractor, this SCNG, who went in and basically said, okay, we'll assure that there'll be nothing under this right-of-way, and took every shrub and tree, and maybe they weren't the best, but right down to a nub. And that's what started this whole cycle of events. And when I spoke with Roger the first time on the phone, he was very receptive to this, you know, understanding the situation. Obviously, it's happened before. Hopefully, it won't happen too much in the future, but I don't know what the city's connection with SCENG and those right-of-ways are, and I'm not going to go there. I'm speaking specifically of this piece of property. I brought with me the president of the Aiken County Historical Society, Alan Riddick, and if you have any historical questions about this particular very special intersection, he could answer them. And I think, as either Roger or Larry pointed out, it's within 100 yards of what used to be the Highland Park Hotel, which burned in the late 1800s. 1898. And aside from that, contiguous to this intersection area are a series of steps that were part of the old Highland Park Hotel. So aside from being a neighborhood issue, it becomes more of a historical or combined issue here. And I have some folks that are neighbors to the area that are here with me, and I'm sure they may like to speak. I don't know if they have that opportunity, but I hope they do, because I don't want to miss anything on behalf of them. But from what you've described in terms of the plannings, it seems appropriate. Roger, I noted in the letter that I sent you that I was looking for more specifics on, you know, basically what was going to happen, because sometimes when I go back to my neighbors and say, well, there's going to be some meaningful plannings done, the interpretation gets kind of garbled. So I this audience here with the city council, I think, is appropriate, and I'm glad to have that opportunity, and thank you very much. Does anybody else from the neighborhood have
certainly to say? If someone else wants to speak, you certainly may do that.
You're doing a great job.
Now we've got to do a great job, right, and get it done.
Well, I think it's a great opportunity for the city to take a very valued area, and I hate to steal the thunder of the Aiken County Historical Society, and I'd like Alan to tell you a little bit about the marker that's going to be placed soon.
Good.
To be.
If good. That's please, okay. Please do, Alan. Yeah.
My name is Alan Riddick, and I live at 1111 Parsons Lane. And Paul got involved with this because somehow he heard about our historical marker. But originally, we wanted to put a historical marker in this area, of course, for the hotel. We have it actually in my garage right now. We have a historic garage. And but we would love to put this marker where this little park is going to be made, this little clearing, and improved upon. Because if you look at where this marker is going to be, and you're reading this marker, you're looking right up where the hotel would have been. I mean, you could throw a stone at it. And also, it would give good visibility to cars riding by on Highland Park Drive plus Highland Park Terrace. So We haven't asked permission yet from the city, and I haven't scheduled that yet, but I do plan to do that in the very near future, because we have a ceremony planned for late February for this historical marker. So,
okay, very good. Okay, Paul, sure.
And one last thing, I'd like to thank Jane Vaughters for suggesting that maybe I bring this forward, and I think it's the right thing to do. I had reservations about it, but because of the historic nature in the neighborhood, I think it's great.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I'm glad you did, too, because I've had a couple of people talk to me about the way trees being cut, you know, by SC&G. And I wanted to ask, maybe someone can tell me, Roger, or someone can tell me, what kind of understanding do we have with SC&G about cutting trees? At one time, years ago, I heard that, well, when they cut, especially by, you know, electric wires and what have you, they cut for a 10-year period so that they don't have to come back for 10 years. So in other words, 10-year growth. Now, I don't know if we have what agreement we have or we don't have, but what I'm getting to here, I think we need to sit down with them and discuss some of the cutting. Down by Joy Cottage, they drastically did some cutting. Down Kershaw Street, according to Gail King, they did some pretty drastic cutting. Now, I recognize that the problem you get sometimes is these trees grow up, you know, and they're right under a power line. And we certainly don't want our power to go out because of trees getting involved with the power lines. But on the other hand, sometimes it looks like they cut a little bit more than they have to. But that's just my opinion. Do we have any kind of agreement at all? Larry, do you know, or anybody know? Do we get another question? Do we get notice when they're going to be cutting in a certain area? And perhaps does someone go out and, like Tom Rapp's crew or someone, maybe go out and see what they're doing or advise them? Because I know these contract folks, there might be one contractor one week in some place and another one another week. And I wonder how much they really cherish our trees like we do.
The answer to that's fairly complicated, Mr. Mayor. As in this situation right here, the contractor really did not notify us until more or less after the fact. Where they have worked, especially in the downtown parkways, we were notified. Tom does go out and meet with the contractors before they ever start to talk with them about what they're doing. I know all of y'all have seen trees that look like they have a huge V notch cut out of the middle of them. Tom has assured me that, unfortunately, that is an accepted standard practice nationwide for cutting trees under power lines. That's just the way it has to be done, unfortunately. So Tom does keep an eye on them. Can we say that we get notified 100% of the time? No, we don't. They do not notify us 100% of the time. I don't know of any written agreement that we have with them that sets down certain steps that they should have to do with us. Of course, we have our franchise agreement that has been worked out with them over the past few years and we're currently operating under. But they do have the right to cut trees under their power lines and their utilities. That's a state regulation. We can't stop it, but at least in most of the cases, you know, they do work with us and Tom does meet with their crews. Even though we may not like the looks of it, especially with the V-notch through a nice-looking tree, we cannot stop that normally.
But I can testify from my personal experience that they certainly don't notify us in the neighborhood at all and do this kind of a job. Look at this picture that Paul has. Every single branch has been cut off until of a height of about 70 feet. And that happened in our yard. We've lost three major trees because of their massacring those trees so that they were not even safe to have in the yard any longer. And I came home two summers ago, and they were pruning a big old oak tree and letting the limbs drop on a fence we had just repaired the month before. And the crew was from North Carolina. They didn't know a thing about Aiken. They weren't bad guys. Well, they shouldn't have let the big limbs drop on the fence. That was rude, but and not safe either for either them or us. But there was and I was not happy, and they stopped. But I did get a letter from SCNG, a very nice one, telling me that it was their right to do this when they wanted to do it, essentially. So I called the man, and he said, well, they always, you know, would consult us. Well, that's not so. And that was a while back. And I'm hoping that we've talked with them, and I think we should continue to do this, because in the Hayne Avenue area where Paul is talking about where these pictures are from, we haven't gotten the treatment that South Boundary, for example, has, where there is a way to trim a tree without making a V in it or without taking off every single branch so that it's completely lopsided. I mean, look in Charleston, look in any city that's a major tree city. And there are ways to do this. But I shudder to think what's going to happen the next time they send one of those out-of-state crews down Hayne Avenue. We spent all this money, and I'm telling you, and they won't. They don't want to bury the wires now. So that's why I was thinking that your suggestion that we speak with them is so timely, because we've just had this discussion about how they do not want to bury wires. So if they don't want to, then how appropriate it is that we ask for a better job for our neighborhood. And I don't think that V business is acceptable at all. I mean, that's just horrible looking. And frankly, I don't see that it makes a particularly safe situation with this big weight on both sides. We had an oak split that they cut like that, frankly. Yeah. So I don't know. It's not a hard and fast thing, but I think your suggestion that we speak and talk about it ahead of time is a good thing.
I think at the very least that we ought to be notified whenever they're going to come in. I know that's a big thing. We've got a lot of trees. We love our trees, but trees can give us some headaches too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think, Mr. Mayor, if we tell SCNG about the culture of this town and what our expectations are, and each contractor that they bring on, they all get the same. They can do it in a memo or however they want to do it, but I think the problem here is communications, and I would think that the persons that did this job probably thought they did a good job. They thought they did you all a favor by clearing this area out and said, hey, we're going to make it safer for them. So, but not understanding the culture of this town. I don't think that they did it in a malice way. They were just doing what they thought was a good job.
I agree with you, Leslie, but I still think they ought to have a quick meeting with somebody and Tom Rapp's staff, if necessary, to give them the lowdown. 5 minutes. That maybe that's all it took. We can't continue to have this. Let's put it bluntly on the table. I know that they've got to cut the trees. We all know that. And a lot of times trees are planted the wrong kind of tree. Take the Red Lobster going down Whiskey Road. I look over there every time I go down. I saw those trees when they were just 5 feet tall. And I said, one of these days, this is going to be a problem. Right under the power lines. And now they're into the power lines. I don't know when that's going to be a problem, but they are. But we need some control.
We'll just cut the top out of it.
I'm tired of getting phone calls on this subject. I know you are.
I totally agree, Mayor.
I know our staff. I don't know why that would be hard to do. You say, how much of the time do you get notified?
Well, in the case of Ms. Vodders, that she's saying we did not get notified until we got a phone call from some of the neighbors saying, you know what's happening down here.
Well, I know that, but how many? Yeah. I thought you said that sometimes you're not notified.
Correct.
Is it a majority of the time you are notified?
I would say probably the majority of the time we are notified, but it only takes once in a neighborhood, and that tree's to use the same term. That tree is massacred.
Well, they've got managers in this city. I got an SEEG manager, and you've got a SCANA manager who we all know over him, over them, right? Why can't we sit down with them and talk to them about this and get an agreement? Is it going to cost us some extra money to do that? Maybe it will. But it might be worth it, too.
Yeah. Even when we do know that they're coming to town, though, they're going to have to cut the trees.
Okay. I'm not saying not cut the trees.
And in other words, we... Just like this past summer when they came in along, and they do it every 5 years, not every 10 years.
Good, okay, that's good.
The reason on South Boundary we don't seem to have the problem is because we told them we don't want them to cut any trees and we'll do all the cutting ourselves. So we take on that expense 100%. I talked to their vice president about it this summer. His name is Keller Kazam, and had a long talk about it. In fact, he's supposed to be talking to his folks, how about paying us to cut the trees instead of having their crews come in, and that we'll go ahead and cut it, knowing we're going to lose some money. And it wouldn't be on every area, but again, they're going to want to cut back so that there is at least a few years versus of growth that's going to be available before they start getting to the wires. You are going to have a U-shape or a V-shape in many cases. What we're trying to do, like on Hayne Avenue, is we just need to make sure that as we replace these trees, we put, one, the appropriate size tree there. And if we are going to plant oaks, don't plant them right underneath the power line. Plant them 10 to 15 feet on either side of the power line so that, again, we're not going to be facing this issue 5, 10, 15 years from now. You mentioned Red Lobster. Frankly, they put an inappropriate type of tree planted at that location, because it's not even going to be a few years from now, but within probably a year or two, they'll be topping those trees off at a 14, 15-foot height instead of them getting up to 60-foot like that tree would normally grow to its natural ability. So one of our jobs is a long time ago is Tom Rapp started coming up with what is the appropriate size trees and the type of trees to plant in certain areas. And then we've been looking at over the last 10, 15 years is as we start going through areas, let's get the right trees planted and planted in the right location so that we're not facing the same situation 10, 15, 20 years from now. But I'll be happy to talk to Keller, and I'll put something right in the next week or so to him that, if he doesn't notify us, we'll be sending along the police to go ahead and stop them from working.
Well, and another comment that I just wanted to mention when I talked to the fellows that were doing the work, I said, why didn't you do this more carefully? He said, oh, well, our job is to get from here to here in one day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the way to do the job. We all know that.
We've got two other comments from the mayor.
Okay, so, sure. Lee?
Yeah. About you guys.
Okay, Jan, you first.
Jan Smith, 193 Dogwood Road. In fact, the mayor and I happened to be at the County Museum when I mentioned him the butchery job that was done on Easy Street. Mm-hmm. If you all get the chance to drive down there, it is absolutely awful. And yet there's areas of town, like on Two Notch, where there's pine trees and the wires and everything. I personally think the contractors don't give a hoot, and I think they actually take some joy in doing a butchering job, and yet other areas are neglected. So I would really like to see the city take a stronger hand in this, because y'all need to go down Easy Street. It is really awful. They really butchered that street.
Thank you, Jan. Lee, excuse me.
I'm Lee Poe. I live on Rollingwood Road, and I was Park Commission chairman for a good number of while. And we had some success in terms of dealing with SCNG. Probably the biggest disaster is over by Schofield, where they came in there and put those big, massive high-tension high power lines in. But we had after that we had several meetings with South Carolina Electric and Gas, and we were able to get a much better job done. Now, I don't know what that means, but let me caution you, there are other contractors doing the same thing. Fred, you know right up from where you live, the railroad came through there and must have cut a 75-foot swatch of everything and just left it, and it's just eroding away. We need to do something there, and it's not a park commission, so it's not part of the park commission job, but somebody needs to go in there and replant. They even come out periodically and spray the volunteer stuff, which would help us if nothing else.
Yeah, and it's
I encourage the city to work with all of these guys.
Right.
Not just SC&G, but all of them ought to be part of our keeping Aiken pretty.
Right.
Thank you.
That's their land too that they're doing that on.
That's all right.
I know that doesn't make us very happy, but it is still their land. Let's not forget property rights and that kind of thing. Now, Lee, you will recall we did get them back down here. I had to go to the paper to get an article to help get them back here, unfortunately. And they cleaned up a lot of stuff. But as you said, there's still a lot that rolled down the hill, and tree limbs and trunks that roll down the hill, it's still there. But you're absolutely correct. We do need to have conversations with just anybody that's cutting. And those two firms are the ones that were primary, I think.
You think we could talk with, or you could talk with them pretty soon, or somebody could talk with them? Because
Roger said he was going to talk with, what, the VP?
I was going to send him a letter.
Okay. We need to talk to David Model, too, I think. David is the manager for SCANA here. And
he's
of course,
not here.
Of course, SCENJ, huh?
Said he's not here.
No, he's not here tonight, but he does sit in many times. But I think he has some responsibility too over SC&G. You know, SCANA does, and of course we know the manager for SC&G as well.
I think they're looking for a timetable and a prescription based on the memo from Paul Sarborn as to what we're going to do.
Thought Roger, what did you have to us for us in as far as the timetable?
It's
going to
be this winter. I can't tell you what week and when the trees come in, and
it's in our note. Did you understand that, Paul?
Paul's over here.
Paul, I'm sorry. I thought you said
the criticality of the schedule, I think, was the fact that because of the historic marker placement, which I'm sure Tom
it'll be done before the end of February.
Will be agreed upon. So, you know, that I was just
okay.
And of course,
well, that's February. You hope to do that, right, Alan?
Yes, I like
that. The best time for planning is December, January, and that they'll be in.
That'd be great.
Again, it all depends on when we get our delivery of our trees.
Okay. This was information for us, so there's no vote right. necessary, but I think you understand the feeling of council.
Certainly.
Certainly.
I'm Martina Conrad, 531 Highland Park Terrace. The cement steps are actually on mine and my husband's property. And prior to the plants being installed, will the neighborhood be allowed to basically bless it? Is that something that could be done, that we could see what the plan will be prior to, since we'll have to drive by it and live next door?
We've never done that before, but I mean, I guess the question is, if you don't like it, we could let you know what. We're going to come up with something that Tom Rapp, who's the arborist in town,
right.
certified arborist, he feels is most appropriate.
Correct.
So, I mean, we're just not going to put anything in there. Where did Larry go again? There he is over there again. I mean, he doesn't draw up a set of plans. So, I mean, I guess we could have him go out there someday and meet with you and say he's going to put a dogwood here, redbud here, and
are you the closest? You're the closest.
The stairs are right on our property.
All right. Okay.
Did you have suggestions on what planning you thought would
there
be
there are
fitting?
Some concerns within the neighbors that prior to the, well, now it's just cleared, there was a buffer, there was a little bit of privacy, there was somewhat of a screen, and now one of the neighbors can see directly into the front of the Llewellyn's house, which is on Highland Park Drive,
right.
And she's on Highland Park Terrace. So, you know, there was a bit of a woodsy feel to it, and I guess we're just concerned that it would be a lot of ornamental varieties that wouldn't be...
It's not going to be a woodsy appearance anymore.
Okay.
It's going to be a landscape appearance.
Correct.
With just
but
trees.
We know what that is prior to it going in, I guess.
We're going to have any crepe myrtles there, maybe?
Again, that's up to Tom Rapp.
Well, why don't we have
a lot of
it's
dependent on where the sun is and you know how it shades in those areas.
Well, you've got to use more of that stuff that, you know, that bark that gets all over everything.
He's going to have to put something that's not going to erode easily.
That is right down the street the first time we're on the sidewalk. We've had that all over our sidewalks.
Well, and it is a hill.
And it is a hill.
If you want to leave your name with Larry Morris, we could go ahead and have Tom meet with a group of you.
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Martina. Does anyone else want to speak on the issue? Okay, we'll move on.
Meeting
for December. Yes, Mr. LaDuke.
We'd like you to consider...
Paul, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead.
The second meeting that we typically would have in December is on the 22nd. That's the week of Christmas, a couple of days before. And so we're recommending we only hold one meeting in December. Critical subject would come up, we certainly could call a meeting. So for your consideration, we'd like to cancel the second meeting of council in December.
Okay. Do we have a motion in a second?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Anybody want to meet? Okay, I don't hear any.
Some quick motions down there on the other end.
All in favor of this? Okay. Passes unanimously, as it has in years past. Okay, is Mr. Winfield here?
He's not, but Reverend Jenkins is here, and she may want to make some comments regarding the MLK signage.
Good evening, all. Brenda Lynn Jenkins, 804 Dillon Avenue, Aiken. I was a little perplexed at seeing it, so I was unprepared really with any formal comments. But I do hope that the council would move with dispatch and this street naming. We've been trying to coordinate this with the state and with the county, and that's been very difficult, if not almost impossible. But with that being said, we would hope that the city would move with their piece of it and in this honor as you've committed to do.
Okay. Can we talk a minute about how many signs, what would the sign say, and where would it be? Any of those details been discussed?
We're talking about an overlay. Right now it's Highway 19.
That's right.
And what is being asked is, and if you visit other towns, I was just in Greenville, there are markers saying Dr. Martin Luther King Memorial Highway.
Right.
And you're not talking about changing streets or requiring people to change their addresses, those kinds of things, but markers where the city limit begins. And we can get with your group or whomever to determine Winfield, since John Winfield has, the gentleman that's been sitting here, has been one that has had a keen interest in getting this done.
I remember a call I got from him, yes.
And I certainly want to add to that. I don't think that it's being asked that anything be displaced and replaced,
right,
or substituted,
right,
but just that addition to the already existing signage.
Does the highway department have to be involved in this? I think they do, because it's a state road, most of it. If not all of it.
If we want to make this complicated, it can be. But just as we place signs that says someone is picking up trash, that group, we make those signs all the time. Do we not? Or do we get the state's permission to do that?
It's,
oh, no, that's
on the major highways, those are state signs.
The state makes those signs?
Not in the city and at parks. No. Make sure you understand that.
Yeah, there's little parkway signs that we put up there, but the very large signs are done by the state.
I think that what we're asking the city to do is do that part that the city controls, and we would probably continue to work with the largest signage.
If we're to put a sign on the state right away, other than a street sign, then we'll have to go ahead and get their permission. But certainly we could go ahead and put in a highway permit if council wants us to. Let me give you a little bit of background, and I'm not totally prepared for this because I thought we were going to talk about the next meeting. But in the mid-90s, City Council approved an overlay district or an overlay highway designating Route 19 from that's in our city limits as the MLK, Martin Luther King Memorial Highway, I think is the way it was approved, but without any signage. And that then the county and the state were also going to be asked to do this so that from I-20 on through the city area, you would still be Lauren Street or Whiskey Road, but it would also have an overlay of calling it the Martin Luther King Memorial Highway. And that another group was going to go ahead from the minutes and put up some markers and some designations. I believe what you're now asking is that the city would go ahead and put up any signage or markers for that.
I'm sorry, Jane.
Don't we have some right-of-way where we could... I mean, I'm confused always, and it's going to pertain to this next thing we discussed, too, about how far back the state's right-of-way goes, and is there not a spot that's city right-of-way that's visible that we could put up a tasteful sign? We might not even like the state sign. We might not think it's very attractive. But we have a design we like to use for things in Aiken. I mean, it seems to me that it ought to be compatible with that, and it would seem that we might have some right-of-way where an appropriate sign could go.
And the bottom line is there is a designation of a street and no of a roadway and no signage. And let us do what is proper. And I think we are all about doing that.
Yeah. So. We talked about this last year when I was...
We're talking about a legality here now.
Yeah. Oh, I understand that.
I don't know that anybody's against what you...
No, I don't.
Right, they are.
We weren't back
right
then in the 90s.
No.
But we're talking about a legal thing here. And whether on a state road they have the right-of-way, but whether the city has a right-of-way after that, I don't know.
Well, we'll find out how Greenville, Charleston, Atlanta, Spartanburg did it, and we'll bring that information to you.
And the rest of the country.
It's a problem with the state. It's just a process probably of going through.
Yeah, I think all we have to do is submit a highway permit saying we want to put up a sign on their right-of-way and get their permission. I do know that when we've tried to put up materials that were subject to cars running into, like a brick type of a monument, for instance, at the entrance of the city, let's take on Highway 1 at the bypass. We have a Welcome City of Aiken sign. It's about 15, 20 feet wide. And again, it had to be so many feet off the roadway, and it just has to follow certain requirements to place it there just for the safety of vehicles that are going through there. If you're looking at a metal sign, like you've seen a lot of places, it becomes a lot easier because the brackets that if somebody hit it are more breakaway type of a post that would not interfere with the vehicle as much. We do not, to my knowledge, own any property on Highway 19 that we could put up a sign. The right-of-way along there, I imagine, is probably about 80 to 100 feet wide, so about from 40 to 50 feet from the center of the 19 on out is Highway Department property, and we'd have, if we want to put in that area, in other words, on the shoulder area, like where you see typically signs, it's just a matter of asking them for permission, and I'm sure... as long as we do something that's not going to cause a safety problem, they'll give us permission.
May I ask, in terms of what you're suggesting, that paperwork to get that permit, what's the procedure on that? It's just a matter of paperwork?
Yeah, it typically is a matter of paperwork. I wouldn't foresee a problem.
Is that the course of least resistance? to do the...
Again, it all depends on, you know, what type of, you know, are we looking at a metal sign being, say, 6 feet wide by 2 feet high, or, you know, what? We just need to have some parameters on what.
Does the city presently have any designated signage on any streets that the city has placed?
Not to my knowledge.
On those.
The Jefferson Davis Highway, there is a sign.
But that's county.
But I'm saying signage of that nature. Yeah. So we can take photographs of signs of designation. That will help you.
This is a standard sign I've seen all over
right.
the country. I mean, it's a POW Memorial Highway. It's a Sheriff John Smith Memorial Highway. We're not reinventing the wheel. And I think we talked about this when I shortly after I came on the council. I believe it was at the Planning Commission. But
we're just talking about the process. It's necessary. That's what we're doing.
Right.
We're not saying nobody wants to do it. We're talking about you've got to go through these steps because it's not our road.
If council does not mind, so that we don't, we currently have an ordinance that says designate that area, but it says there will not be a sign there. So we're not in violation of an ordinance that was passed in the 90s saying there wouldn't be a sign there. I'd like to bring it back to you in December saying that this ordinance that was passed, let's just say it was in 1995, that we'd now like to go ahead and change the conditions that we would put a sign up, and I'll try to come up with, you know, what has been approved in the past, so that we get a affirmative vote, not rescinding but modifying what we have already approved.
I thought we did that last year. I don't know why.
What you did last year was, I think it was Mr. Winfield that came here and said, could we go ahead and possibly designate Buford Street?
It wasn't that. Because I recall being in the audience at the Planning Commission when they were talking about the sign on 19, and I thought it was in the middle.
Now, that leads to a question. It seems to me a year ago or so there was some discussion about this, and there was a little bit of difference of opinion. And I wasn't at that particular meeting. Was that, I don't know what meeting that was.
Planning?
And there are groups on different sides, I guess, as to what you really wanted. Are we all together now that this is what we want?
I think that after the various groups or community groups spoke, Mr. Winfield's first impetus was a designation of any kind. And I think that's how the Buford Street was suggested, whereupon the community said, well, the council had already approved virtually the naming board without the signage, so let's honor mm-hmm. what you had already done and then put the signage mm-hmm. there, at which point we all agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Roger, one question that I have. Now, this would be Highway 19 through the city of Aiken, south side.
Again, that's something we have to go ahead and talk about. Is it? Do we want to have one near Talitha Church Road saying it? Because again, if I recall correctly, you were going to try to get the county and the state to allow 19 from around I-20 on in to be this memorial highway.
What right now we have on the south side of Aiken, there's a sign. I don't know how long it's been named.
It's
that, whatever.
Brinkley,
it says
Highway
Brinkley
or,
Memorial Highway.
So I doubt if we could have it on the south side.
I didn't know where that started or ended.
Well,
or
the discussion at the meeting, this came up, and we would bring it all the way to the point where the Brinkley Highway sign begins. Yes.
Okay.
I'm not too sure where that is.
Remember that? That was the sign originally that was placed on the corner of South Boundary and Whiskey Road in front of Ryberg's home where he lived at that time.
Correct, that's right.
And then it was decided
and it was,
should be moved.
Yeah, the neighborhood objected to it because it was so, that wasn't a good looking sign though. It still is,
that's right.
Still looks bad.
But you still need to go to the county to get the county to do its portion in the area that the county controls, because I don't think we can go to the state and ask to put a sign up on the county portion of it.
We have someone here who can speak to the issue.
May I?
Yes.
I plan on speaking about this, but...
That's all right, County Councilman. We can blame the county on it.
City limits on 19 are approximately one half mile north of the bypass.
Okay.
that's where the city limit starts.
I'm the resident council person.
What's your name?
South, my name is Scott Singer. I reside at 317 Live Oak Road, Aiken, South Carolina, 29803. I'm the resident council person for the south side of Aiken, and I would welcome an opportunity to join the city in the appropriate designation and help sponsor that petition. Of course, I need to go through county council for such a thing, and we have a meeting coming up December 8th, and I'll be glad to carry that banner if need be. But I'm not sure exactly where the Brinkley sign begins. I know where it's located, but I don't know how long that stretch is. But we could even, depending on how aggressive we wanted to be, even talk with our friends from the city of New Wellington to see if we want that entire stretch. So just let me know.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Wouldn't it be more obvious if it were closer to that intersection with Rutland Drive and Lawrence? So that, I mean, it's just out in the middle of the side of a field. It's not going to be very, people don't even slow down. You know what I'm saying. So if we're going to do it, it ought to look nice and it ought to be visible, I think. That's just my suggestion. That it not
and
just
speaking
be.
With council, county council person Hightower, he has agreed also to be in support of that. I don't know what movement has been done on that. And in conversations with Representative Clyburn and Senator Tomasi, they have verbally expressed agreement. But I have no idea what the procedure is to do that. I'll leave that to our competent city manager to do so. And in terms of the design, I'll leave that. I just think that the community will not quibble about what the design is going to look like, but just the fact that the honor would be designated. And I think we would be very much in agreement with whatever the design team would come up with. So, thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. Okay, let's see. Scott, would you like to come and speak about your issue that was added? It has to do, excuse me, issue that you added to the agenda.
Thank you both for being here tonight and discussing this very important initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you, Councilman Smith, for having me here tonight. Again, my name is Scott Singer, and I have a very able county attorney with me, Jim Holly, in case I say something that needs to be corrected. But I wanted to go ahead, if I could, and just give a little bit of background. And the best way to give this background is I'm here to talk about the B&W Salvage Yard and Southside Automotive off of Highway 1. And you may recall from reading the newspaper, but about a year ago, I was becoming increasingly frustrated with the fact that I was getting telephone calls from residents both within the city of Aiken and outside in the county-only area regarding trucks being parked on the right-of-way at that particular establishment. I also had conversations with our friends from the Economic Development Partnership and learned that at least one potential client had expressed reservations when first coming into the gateway of the city of Aiken and seeing that particular site. And it's kind of made it very apparent to me that certainly it's an eyesore, but it's an eyesore that has negative consequences with respect to economic development and the things that we want to do for our citizens here in Aiken County. And so I sponsored a resolution asking county council to pass to go to the delegation, our state delegation, to ask the South Carolina Department of Transportation to vigorously enforce the right-of-way at that particular establishment. What I'd like to read into the record, if I might, is a letter from the attorney for the South Carolina Department of Transportation, Beecham Brooker, to Senator Greg Ryberg, who basically carried that resolution forward to SEDOT on behalf of Aiken County Council. And I'll just read the, I think, the most relevant sections. Dear Senator Ryberg, I am responding to an inquiry from your office concerning junkyard encroachment on the highway right-of-way of U.S. Route 1 just west of the Aiken city limits. As you may be aware, the department has had a long history with B&W Salvage Yard and Southside Automotive, both owned by Edward F. Willing. In 1985, the department sought a permanent injunction against Mr. Willing and B&W Inc. in the Aiken Circuit Court to require the removal of certain vehicles and personal property from the right-of-way. Prior to trial, the parties entered into a settlement agreement, which was subsequently approved in an order signed by Judge Rodney A. Peoples on January 8, 1986. Under the agreement and the order, the defendant was not to allow junked vehicles or junk equipment to be parked on the right-of-way for any extended period of time. Junked vehicles and junk equipment were defined as motor vehicles or heavy equipment incapable of moving under their own power. In 2000, we, SCDOT, petitioned the court for an interpretation and enforcement of the 1986 order in light of Mr. Willing's bad faith in complying with it. His arguments at the time were that most of the equipment on the right-of-way could move under its own power, and as the other equipment, it was only there until space could be found on the interior of his yard. The result was an agreement to move trucks on the southern side of the highway to accommodate the city's beautification project, the cypress trees that were planted. But Judge Cooper, the presiding judge at that time, declined to rule on the remaining issues. In light of the foregoing, I have suggested to city and county officials that the likeliest successful solution is to proceed under the Junkyard Control Act, South Carolina Code Annotated 57-27-10, that provides for screening of junkyards from view. Because the Willing establishment are grandfathered under the Act, the cost of the screening must be borne by the government. Therefore, the operator must maintain the screen and ensure that no junk is visible above or beyond it. Penalties are $100 or 30 days in jail for each offense, and each day constitutes a separate offense. As a follow-up to that, Jim's predecessor, Robert Bell, provided counsel with the following, and it's a little bit redundant, but I think it's worthwhile. The relevant code section is 57-2750. This is part of the Junkyard Control Act enacted in 1966 as one of the nationwide Lady Bird Johnson laws. Adequate state regulation of junkyards visible from the highways was required by Congress on pain of partial loss of federal highway funding. New junkyards may not be established unless they are screened from view. However, existing ones, as the Willing establishment, are grandfathered. The owner cannot be required to screen. However, if the government erects the screening, the owner must keep junk behind and below it under penalty of 30 days or $100 each day being a separate offense. South Carolina Code 57-27-80, unfortunately, the General Assembly enacted the law with no corresponding funding. In other words, it's up to us to fund it if we're going to get that screen. Now, frankly, I wish I wasn't here right now. And I think if Mr. Willing was a good corporate citizen and would keep the trucks off the right-of-way, comply with an agreement that he made with County Council Chairman Ronnie Young and Mayor Kavanaugh, it would really be a moot point. But the fact of the matter is he believes he holds all the cards right now and is not willing to act. Senator Ryberg met with representatives of the county and Secretary Buck Limehouse recently, because if we were going to move forward on this, we wanted to make sure that SCODOT was going to absolutely follow the letter of this law. We've gotten assurances from Secretary Limehouse that, in fact, if the county and the city, or either one, is willing to move forward and pay for this fence being erected, that SCDOT will supervise the construction of that fence, ensure that it meets the applicable law that I mentioned to you, and that they will vigorously enforce it to the utmost. I wish we weren't at this point, but frankly, I think it's the only way that we're going to resolve a problem. And if anything, I think it gives us the leverage we need to deal more effectively and forcefully with the property owner in question. And with that, I'll see if Jim would like to make any comments.
Scott, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are we talking about one fence on one side, or are we talking about both sides of the street?
Both sides of the street.
Okay, and who's to build it?
South Carolina Department of Transportation will build it.
They'll build it to their specs?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
How tall will it be? Do you have any idea?
I don't know what their specs are, but the law says that that junk cannot be visible over that fence.
Okay, another question is, what's your definition of junk?
Oh,
I looked at what was on came across, I guess, an email that I got, I don't know, from you or Roger or somebody. It was something from the state legislature, and it seemed to imply to me that junk was something that could not move on its own, for instance. I didn't see anything in there that said that it could be a movable object. In other words,
Mr.
junkyard,
Mayor.
Junk, you're talking about junk.
You're getting into legal thing.
I just want to understand it.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, the statute defines junk as old or scrap copper, brass, rope, rags, batteries, paper, trash, rubber debris, waste, junked, dismantled, or wrecked automobiles, or parts thereof, iron, steel, and other old or scrap ferrous or non-ferrous metal.
Okay, not movable.
That's the statutory definition of junk.
Okay, not vehicles that can move on their own accord.
Right.
And all through this, it says junkyard. Now, obviously, he's got some junk in there, but what we see, unless, and I haven't been up there, or I haven't seen them move. I took pictures for 3 years on this thing. I got involved in this thing, golly, at least 12 years ago. Steve Thompson and I had lunch, took him to lunch, Pee Wee Willie. And we've been all through that, Judge Peoples and what have you. And as you said, Scott, you summarized it by saying he's just not going to move. DOT could do something anytime they wanted to do it. It's there right away. They can move in there right now. This is one of the problems. This is one of the things that makes me most upset. They could do this. They could go in there right tonight, tomorrow, and say, move your stuff back. You're on the DOT right away. And he'd have to do it. And I think the Sheriff's Department could even go in there and do some good by making them move their movable stuff that they've got out there in front, which is only that far from the street, from the highway, because of a safety problem. I mean, that's all in a record, and Gary, you work with this a little bit with me, and Richard worked with me on this, and we're just not getting anywhere. And about 05, I just kind of quit for a while, you know, and because we couldn't get anybody to do anything. And we talked, I've got a long chain of notes in talking to Beecher on this subject up there, the DOT lawyer. And you talked to him, Scott, I guess, or someone talked to him. But now you're saying, that's all history. Now you're saying that there is a way to do something. What guarantees do we have that it's going to come through? Mm-hmm. That he's not going to say, come to court or something, Jim, and hopefully you can tell me, and say, look, I don't have junk out there on the highways. Sure, I've got junk back here. But what you see are vehicles. And how can I sell my vehicles unless they're out here? And the order that I've seen, and I've got copies of, says, it goes back a ways, says that he can have movable vehicles on the right-of-way as long as they're not permanently there. So that's why I took pictures. I'd go up there on the hill and I'd take pictures, you know, every so often to see if they've moved.
And he moves them every now and then.
And not lately.
But anyway, go ahead, Jim. I give
yes,
up. Go ahead.
just in talking about this and thinking about this, I don't like riding in and seeing all that stuff either. And I'm, Mr. Mayor, I'm totally with you on this from the standpoint that there ought to be something that they could do, because he leaves those things there. He might move them just enough to fall within the legal aspects of it or whatever. But, you know, I'd like for them to disappear. But, frankly, I have never seen a screening fence that I like to look at either. And to think that it would be on both sides of the entrance into our city just disheartens me. I would like to see us go forward in some other way, Mr. Mayor, and spend the money that we're going to spend to ensure that he's going to have to move those vehicles off of the state right away.
I agree. The insurance part of it. How can we be assured? You know, I've been disappointed a lot of times. We all have. But because, you know, we got a new judge, and he said, oh, golly, I can't. People's ruled on one side of the street where we have the trees.
that actually do some good, I think, my opinion. But when we went back to him, as I recall, he said, "Oh no, I can't rule on this because you've got to wait. You've got to get the new judge coming in. He'll have to rule on the other side of the road."
Well, now the trees are on state right of way, right?
Yes.
You wouldn't have planted them on his property. I mean, they're
supposedly
on the right of way.
The right of way is back there by the wooden telephone poles.
Okay.
And when he moved them at one time on that one side. The court made them move it, and they've stayed back there by the wooden pole, and then slowly but surely, you know, you can creep to where they are now.
Jim, what is this deal about movable things being able to be sold on state right-of-way? I mean, could any of us just go out there and decide we're going to have a little sale on the state right-of-way entering into Aiken? How can he do that?
Generally along public rights-of-way, you can park vehicles, generally. That's true in the city, as it is in the state. You can park vehicles, but you know, generally, and I'm not up to speed 100% on that, but the problem, I think, is that you've got that right that generally people can park on the side of the road. They can't abandon vehicles, but they can park temporarily on the side of the road. I think the order that was issued in 1986 is not entirely clear, and that lack of clarity causes issues when one goes to try to enforce it, and then trying to prove what happened, when it happened, and interpret the language that's there. And you know, I see this perhaps as two issues. One, you've got the vehicles there that are parked in the right-of-way, but you also have what you can see from the highway, which is not very attractive, which is, I would submit, junk, and could be screened. If it is screened, then the owner of the property has to maintain that screening, and if there's anything that qualifies as junk on the outside of it, on the street side, they can be prosecuted after being given notice. So I see that I would assume there are two concerns. One is what you can see, regardless of the trucks that are parked out there and the trucks. We may have to work more on the trucks to make sure that we have a foolproof system for dealing with those. I think this is seen as a first step to try to deal with the overall issue. Also, I think DOT is willing to work with the funding agencies, if there are funding agencies, on the design and what's there. That it wouldn't be just, this is what it's going to be, period. That they would work, from what I understand, with the funding agencies to have something that would be more appropriate, if you will, than something you might see in some other area of the state. From what I've read of the file, I think Mr. Bell and Mr. Brooker saw this approach that Councilman Singer's talked about as the best, most effective approach that's available to deal with the overall issue. And to obtain screening. I think that, you know, I cannot guarantee to county council or to this body that there's going to be a specific result, but we do have DOT's attention, and they want to work with the city and county to try to resolve this, and we have that from the Secretary of Transportation himself, not just from their staff. And it may be that we need to work through this over a matter of maybe a couple of months to make sure we have all the components of the solution. But I think this is what I think county council thought an important first step.
I have another question, or maybe this is the same question. I don't know. If we just decided random people just to park along the front of Mr. Willing's property, we could do that as long as our vehicle was moved every so often?
Well, I think, you know, that's... I would need to double check that, but that you can, you know, leave a car temporarily on the side of the right of one.
But temporarily, is I couldn't park my car out there and leave it for a month or 2 months.
It seems like the law is 72 hours, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Or, Jim, I don't know.
I'm not sure what it is.
Those things have been out there.
You can temporarily park your car in front of Jim's office on Park Avenue.
Right, I know that. But I was just thinking, I know in the parkways, for example, there's a limit to how long people can park vehicles in the city parkways. They can't just park a horse trailer out there and leave it as long as they feel like it.
The city has a specific ordinance about that for abandoned vehicles. If somebody's car broke down and they didn't pick it up in 3 days or whatever it is,
well, they enforce it.
They have somebody come and tow it in.
And they also enforce it on trailers. People can't just park a trailer out there in the parkway and leave it. And that's not an abandoned vehicle, but they can't just leave it there. The thing that I don't see, Scott, I think your motives are wonderful, but for three things.
Let me say a couple things.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, because I don't think I mentioned this, so I think I'm assuming that you all know this, and it may be incorrect, but council voted last Tuesday night to allocate $50,000 to work jointly with the city on this issue. The way I look at this, there's no doubt that this is not foolproof. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to stand up here as our attorney said, and say that there's not pitfalls here. But the fact of the matter is neither the city nor the county have standing with respect to this order. We are not a party to the order, right? And therefore, the first step we would have to do if we want to enforce what's existing is we'd have to actually make ourselves a party to this order, okay? With a considerable legal expense. This is the things I'm probably not supposed to say, right? So what we need here is we need some tools in the toolbox. We need some leverage. Then we sit down with Mr. Willing and say, look, this is an issue. It's detriment to the city. It's a detriment to the county. We need to sit down with you, and let's do this. Or, yeah, maybe we don't get those vehicles, but we get everything else. Yeah? And so I think we need to have a strategy as it relates to this issue. And like I said, county council is willing to put $50,000 up as a show. And obviously, this is as big a city issue as it is for a county issue. Thank you.
My comments are these. The state hasn't enforced the right-of-way, as far as I can tell. So we build a fence. So he puts junk in front of the fence. So then what are we going to do? We're going to have to go to court to get the junk moved? They haven't moved the junk now. That's one thing that concerns me. I mean, they haven't done it. We've got those nice trees. The trees would shield everything if he just put stuff behind him, but he won't do it. Number two, I was thinking about this all weekend. We drove up to Virginia and back on Highway 29 through the valley. There's a auto salvage yard that has a fence around it, but it's on a down slope just like that salvage yard is on the south side. And you can see everything. I mean, the fence is 7 feet tall, but you look down the hill and there it all is. And it's an ugly fence, like Don said. It's a plastic looking thing and it looks awful. But I just don't see what we're going to do to keep him from putting junk in front of the fence if the state won't enforce this rule, the laws they have. Thirdly, he's going to love the attention. I mean, come on. He loves it. You saw that article in the newspaper.
Let me address those three issues, okay? And I'm not an attorney, so if I start practicing law here, Jim, okay? The reason the SCDOT is not enforcing the existing right-of-way is because the order that was written in 1986 is so vague, it doesn't give them good legal standing. This Act 57-2710 supersedes any local judge's order, and therefore they will enforce it. I mean, we've got the commitment from the secretary sitting in the room with the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee. That's pretty darn powerful.
Why don't they do it now?
Because the law, the order that was written by the judge is so vague, it doesn't give them adequate legal standing.
You mean they don't have, it's their right-of-way, right? But yet they don't have the wherewithal to do anything about their right-of-way. I find that extremely hard to understand.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, the effort to do something was through the court action back in 1986, which reached...
Just as a general...
Well, I think they have the hurdle of that order being there that they have to deal with before they go to any other type of enforcement. And this legislation that would be implemented, you have to have the screening there to implement the Junkyard Control Act. So that triggers the enforcement. If you have the screening, then you can enforce it. And DOT has indicated, stated, that they would enforce it with regard to any junk being outside the screening if the screening is erected. So that you have to have the screening to trigger the act. And they see this as a more effective tool to achieve the results that they believe the local communities want. Okay.
But assuming all those trucks, those vehicles he has outside are movable on their own power, he could still put those out there.
That's an issue we'd have to address, whether this act covers that. There's an argument that it does. If there's an argument that the act does cover it, you know, he may or may not challenge that.
You know, let me tell you, the bottom line for me, I have a hard time agreeing to put up to $50,000 of our taxpayers' money on something this vague that we have no assurances yet, and DOE is not taking, obviously not taking any actions. But you're saying they can't because of law. Well, and I find that kind of hard to believe.
I think, do you want to take action that's has a greater chance of succeeding and achieving the results or one that has less of a chance? And I think their deliberation has reached the conclusion that this that we're talking about tonight has the greatest chance of succeeding and achieving the results that are desired, whereas what's been tried in the past has been less than successful, so we need a new solution.
Why are we calling it a junkyard? It's an auto salvage business. Let's don't use the Junkyard Control Act. I mean, I couldn't go out there again and put a fireworks stand on state right-of-way and sit there and in a trailer that is movable or a Winnebago that is movable and do business out of it. I couldn't do that. And maybe if we don't call it a junkyard, maybe if we call it a business and he's doing business on state right-of-way, we get farther.
I think the order that was obtained back in 86 really has muddied the water, in my opinion. It's seen as a potential solution, and to some extent it's muddied the water. And if I may just put it in simple terms, I think the EDP and county council is concerned about trying to find some solution to this issue, which has been around, as the mayor knows, despite significant efforts by this group, this council, and others to try to solve it, and they're looking for a way to solve it, and this is the most effective solution that we are aware of based on our review and our discussions with DOT, and that's what it's being proposed as. It's not perfect, but it's the best one available if a solution is desired in the short term.
Mr. Holley, it's my understanding that, or maybe, and I want you to verify or correct me if I'm wrong here. So it's actually the judge's order that's muddying the water from them enforcing the 72-hour?
Yes, sir. I think that's, if I may put it this way, Mr. Wells, a partially educated a comment by me, but that's my observation, and I think that's borne out by some extent to the fact that they've had difficulty enforcing the order.
So it's all due really to the judge's order
that's
causing the problem there.
In my opinion, that's part of the problem. Yes, sir.
What do we have to do to get another judgment?
DOT is DOT's right of way, as it's pointed out, and they have control over it.
So. I mean, something caused that judgment to come forth that's given you the trouble. What do we have to do to get another judgment that would straighten that out, make him do what he's supposed to do to start with, and also DOT doing what they're supposed to do to start with?
I think we have to find a new legal remedy, and that's why we brought this to you.
Is this the legal remedy?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
spending $100,000 of taxpayers' money to put up a fence.
I think that's the.
And they can still drive their motorized vehicles around the front.
That's the. It's my understanding that's the maximum cost. We would hope it would be less than that, based on the design that's chosen.
And then, excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah. But you know, I know it's, Mr. Mayor, a frustrating issue. We don't deny that. It's just we're searching for a solution rather than just to continue to live.
Well, I just think there's another solution.
Right. Well, I don't know of one. Mr. Mayor, that has a good chance.
Well, getting back to my original question, I didn't let you answer. What do we have to do to get another judgment? Go to court again? Do we have to sue? Does the county have to sue them? Or?
Well, to get an order, you'd have to, somebody with standing would have to sue. And DOT is the entity that has that standing. The trouble is, this order was entered into by consent back in 1986.
Okay. So the citizens who pay the taxes and who try to abide by the law have no standard, no standing in this whatsoever.
Yeah. If I may say, it's possible that your attorneys, myself, and DOT can talk more about this to see if there's any other such remedy. I think what's going to come back to is that DOT looked at it a number of times, as well as Mr. Bell, and concluded that what's been approved by county council and suggested to them is the best solution. And the other things I'm sure they looked at as possible avenues for resolving it.
Why can't the state, or can the Attorney General help us on this? I mean, if it's a state right away, we've got these paid political people who are paid. Why aren't they doing this work for us?
I think it's within DOT's jurisdiction, not anyone else's primarily.
Well, what can be done to make them act?
I think they're offering a way.
They're offering for us to spend money to make them act?
Yeah, if I can. No one's more frustrated about this than I am. But the fact of the matter is and I'm a little hesitant to get too much into it, but I'll go ahead and just lay it out. DOT agreed to the consent order. And so now DOT would have to go back and say, whoops. Right? And there's legal precedent, not just Judge Peoples, but then Judge Cooper? Judge Cooper has looked at it and said, I'm sorry, guys, you had your chance. This is what it is. So now, but the problem is now ours. You know, it's not some bureaucrat in Columbia's problem. They don't care. I shouldn't say they don't care. That's the wrong way of putting it. They don't have to live with it each day. We do. And what you have here is an opportunity, if nothing else, give us the leverage necessary to go address this problem. If we say, I'm sorry, you know, we're frustrated with it, we're mad, by golly, we've been working on this thing for 10 years, and I don't want anything more to do with it, then basically what you're saying is you're satisfied with the status quo?
No, you're not.
I appreciate what you're doing, what you said, and I can't believe that there's nothing else to be done.
Well, sometime back, when we planted those greeneries out there, we were told we needed a buffer, and that buffer ended up being those what's planted there. And
well, they agreed to that,
right?
The court agreed to that.
Exactly.
It's in writing.
So my point is, we have done what was requested at that time, and can that not serve as a
screen?
Councilwoman Price, that question.
Okay.
It's a legal question.
I don't disagree with the word
Jimmy said. I was overlooking
something. My comment is that years ago, right, I was here on council when we were wrestling with this problem, agonizing over this problem, and it was more intense then than it is now. We were told to get a buffer, and we concluded that the best buffer was the planting that's there. Does that not give us some room to say, hey, we have this buffer, and he's in violation of what we planted there?
I don't.
Instead of putting up a fence, we put up
right. The screening has to screen it entirely. It has not 100%, but it has to block the visibility significantly. And I think, you know, the trees are spaced, so you can, as you drive by, see what's generally behind them. Screening has to be erected by the department for it to trigger, and it has to be consistent with their overall regulations for it to trigger this act. I don't think we can consider what the city done on its own to try to solve this some time ago would trigger the statute that we're talking about tonight.
Even if we go out there and plant more trees.
Well,
as fast as they're growing,
yeah,
Roger.
The screening can be, as I recall the act, the screening can be vegetation.
And Ms. Price, you've got to bear in mind,
there is some liability issues with planting trees in a right-of-way. If a car hits one of those trees that's driving down the road, and they find out that the state planted that tree, then there could be some liability issues for the state. They're not going to accept that liability.
Well, don't they accept liability now by letting those big old trucks sit out there? Somebody could get killed hitting that.
They didn't place those trucks there. They may allow them to be there, but they didn't place them.
Well, if it's their property they allow it to be there, then I don't see how they can't say they're liable.
Well, the thing
that I'm just having a hard time understanding is if I were to take my vehicle out on Highway 1, out in front of Aiken Tech, and just pulled it off the side of the road, how long do you think it would sit there before somebody would do something?
Richard was talking about this just a second ago. I'm not exactly sure what the procedure is, but I mean, we've all seen not an abandoned car, but a car there's no driver in it sitting on the side of the road on the interstate. Mm-hmm. And you've all seen that tag that somebody sticks on that car.
Yeah.
Well, at some point, if that tag's still there, and I think it's got a date and a time on it, if it's still there in a certain period of time, they'll send a tow truck out and pick it up.
How many hours can that vehicle sit there?
72 hours.
72.
Put on by the highway patrol.
Right.
So if there's a car on the side of the road, if it's causing an immediate hazard, they're towing.
I don't know what the Highway Patrol does now with the vehicles that are parked there at Willings.
72 hours later.
And the problem that I have never ridden by there and seen the first tag on any of those vehicles.
I guarantee you, if you told all those trucks he had to pay for it, we'd see some changes there.
If I can,
but you got to remember, we have no standing to tell the Highway Patrol to do anything.
Does not Mark Sanford or Senator Greg Ryberg?
Well,
if I could, what I'm hearing is a like amount of frustration that I share. We've researched this for a couple of years now, looked at all the different angles. These are the same discussions that we've had. And frankly, this is the solution that we think on the county level is going to be the most effective. Obviously, city council, at least some members of city council, aren't at that point. I would welcome you all to pick up this ball and run with it. And hopefully you can come up with a solution that is less costly to the taxpayer, meets the goals and objectives I think that we all agree to. When county council adopted this resolution, we did not on purpose put a time limit as to when those funds would be available. I can tell you that our fiscal year begins July 1st, 2008. Okay, I would hope that you all can take a look at this, since this is an issue that affects both the city and the county. And if you can come up with a solution that works better than this, believe me, I'll be right with you. If not, I would ask for you to entertain this in the not-too-distant future.
Scott, we still don't have an answer as to whether, even with a fence up there, whether or not those movable vehicles would be up front. And that's been his argument all along. We've been out there. Beecher was out there. We had a whole group out there one time talking with him. You know, and he always maintains you can move those vehicles, and the court order says that as long as it can be moved on its own power, it can stay there, as long as it's not permanent. Isn't that what your understanding is, Jim? I've got it right here in my file.
Yes, sir. The order generally is along those lines.
Yeah. So what's to keep him from moving those vehicles, all the ones we see, assuming they all can run on their own? Around there, so you've still got them out there this far from the highway, and behind them there's the fence. Big deal, you know. Yeah. And then going down that hill, you're not going to have a fence tall enough, as Jane alluded to a little while ago. You're not going to have a fence tall enough to shield some of that real junk.
Yeah, sir. And you know, there sometimes the answers to questions like this unfold as you deal with the issue and try to solve it. I think if we pursued this remedy that we talked about tonight using the statutory process, it could result in more
vigorous enforcement by the Department of Public Safety, which is the agency in which the Highway Patrol is located, for enforcement of the 72-hour rule.
Does that supersede a court order?
Well, it's been offered as a solution, I think, or at least offered as a possible solution by attorneys for the city, is at least a way of perhaps dealing with it. And it may be the type of issue that you have to try a number of solutions before you find the one that works. So I think that, you know, if at least, if unless I misunderstood, I thought that the possibility of trying to get the Department of Public Safety to be more vigorous in its enforcement of what of the 72-hour abandonment rule, assuming it applies, they would, I think, be in a somewhat better position if the screening were there to show the demarcation and then deal with all the collateral issues, the order and whatnot. But, you know, it also, I think, loses sight, if I can may use a pun, of the value of the screening, if it's appropriate, and what that accomplishes in addition to the parked vehicles there. I mean, I think it seems like there are two issues, and trying to deal with both of them. And it may take a combination of solutions. I'm not trying to. This is a complicated issue, and as you know, you worked on it trying to find a solution. And I don't think I think it's going to take some patience and working out these potential solutions to get to the point where I think both the city and county want to get to. And it may be a combination of different things, but I think what county council wants to do is to move the ball ahead and try to get it resolved, as this council has done for some time.
Well, Jim, in your dealings with the with DOT, was there any discussion about other locations in the state where they've done the screening and then tried to enforce it and results that they've had there?
We've had no discussion of that. You know, as you know, the current law requires for you to locate such a facility, you have to have the screening there to get a permit. And so I think probably there have been few of these because of the lack of funding to do it. And obviously, the situation is now, there's definitely not the funding available. I'm not trying to avoid answering your question. I'm trying to give you an honest answer to a complicated situation.
No, I appreciate that, Jim.
Yeah.
I know it's complicated, but you talk about value, you know. I don't see the value yet because I don't understand whether these vehicles can be still out in front of right. the fence
right.
that we spend $100,000 on.
Mr. Mayor, may I suggest something here? And I'll first ask a question, which is basically, gentlemen, if we approved this sharing in principle with an understanding that we're going to carry it forward from this point and get more assurances that it will actually work before we commit to the final thing, is that the way to go? Does that help us? I think it does. But
yeah, this tonight's not the end all, you know, and never has been. And you know, the devil's always in the details, and county council recognize that as well. We just wanted to show a very strong, good faith effort that we're going to work to address this problem. This appears that this is a likely avenue for us to go down. We've got lots of things to work out. Many good questions are asked tonight. But again, we need to keep moving.
Does the county have any leverage at all in renewing business licenses or ensuring he's complying with other county ordinances and so forth? I mean, this guy wants to play by the letter of the law. Is he in compliance with everything?
Well, we don't have a business license in the county. Okay.
Hey, now there's a solution.
you don't want to go there, Councilman Dewar. But you touched on an important word, leverage. Right now, he believes he has all the cards.
Looks that way.
Right? So, let's give us a hand to deal with, and then go deal with him.
Well, using the 72-hour enforcement, trying that. Let's try. We haven't tried that. We haven't tried tagging his trucks out there. By using that, it would shock me if you started tagging his trucks and started hauling them off. That this does not get his attention.
Councilman Price, if you guys move forward with that, I would be delighted.
Let's find out first whether they agree to do that if we put the money up. We're working this thing wrong here. We're asking for money, and then maybe this will happen, and maybe that'll happen.
Well, I'm asking. Okay, I'm letting you know what County Council did, and I'm asking you all to agree in principle to this. That's all.
$50,000. That's what you're asking for. Up to $50,000.
I'm saying what County Council did was we authorized a resolution that said that we would like to enter to a joint agreement with the City of Aiken to spend up to $50,000 each to address this issue. You know, that we put a dollar figure on there, okay? But you know, that's not necessarily what I'm asking for from y'all. I just want, we need to be moving forward, working together to get the situation fixed.
Yeah.
Can we have a chance to take it like this some more
information? Look, yeah. If we were voting on a project here, we want all kinds of information.
Right.
Is that correct? We want to see schematics.
Right.
We want to see house designs. We want to see this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah. And why should we spend $50,000 or $100,000 to give to the DOT to build a fence when they can't even tow trucks off?
I'm
sorry. I thought I made it clear. I said we're talking about something in principle. For goodness sakes, we've been living with this thing for a long time. We have some attorneys in Columbia saying this gives a possibility. Why, for Pete's sakes, can't we commit in principle to this, subject to a lot more clarification later, before we actually expend a penny?
No money. No money.
Well, I would agree. Essentially, what he's asking for is...
We agree in principle. Okay, let's
get the information.
Let's get some answers.
Okay, but should that be in the... should that be in the form of a resolution of council,
yes.
Or just... If you would do that, I think that gives us...
Okay, I'm not willing to agree to up to $50,000 for something that we don't know any more about.
Up to $50,000 if we get to know all this stuff and it satisfies us.
We'll come back to the table and discuss the money.
All right, we get to approve. Okay, we get to approve it. We will approve it.
Yes.
That's not what I understand. This.
Well, this is theirs. I mean, they just entered into it.
That's a couple of hours.
A lot of caveats on it. If we're going to put something up, we don't even know a basic question about whether they move their movable vehicles up, which this order we have says they can.
Mr. Mayor, I might suggest we could prepare a resolution for the next council meeting.
Yes.
For y'all to review and determine whether you want to pass it or not. And perhaps between now and the next council meeting, we could have some other discussions
and
be able to answer those questions for you.
As it goes on.
But you know, I can tell you right now, I don't think anybody's going to be able to say this is going to solve your problem. And I don't think you're not going to hear that.
But two basic things. We've got to know whether they can still move their vehicles up there and then visualize what good that's going to do.
Right.
Certainly it'll be some good. The other thing, what's the other thing? I'll think about it. I think.
Mr. Mayor,
if I may, right now, as I understand it, legally, the state feels enjoined. They can't do anything because they have the judge's decision out there. That's the only thing they have. That's what they fall back on. So, all right, unless we get a game changer in here, that's where we're going to be forever. What they're saying is this is a game changer because then we have another legal stance that we can take on the issue. That's as I understand it.
Let me just say very clearly that we just finished discussing putting a sign on the state's right of way. And we're talking about a sign versus all of these trucks. I mean, and $100,000.
Were it not for the court and that silly judge so long ago.
But you're law-abiding citizens, Ms.
Right.
Price. You're law-abiding citizens.
Gary, could our resolution be that... I mean, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. I know you've done a lot of homework, but could our resolution not... identify. Somebody's got to be in charge of the State Highway Patrol. I want to know why they're not enforcing the law. It appears to me they're not, and I want to know why not. And whoever, I mean, there are branches of government here, and right, a judge makes a rule, but there are executive and legislative branches of government as well. And can't we make some try some way to get somebody that we've elected or are paying as a bureaucrat to do their job? Because these trucks have been there. They have not been there 72 hours. They've been there 7 years, right, for goodness sakes. And none of us could get by with that stuff. None of us. I mean, no one could park out in front of my house for 7 years and not have to move their vehicle. I mean, they couldn't do it. So what's going on?
That's a very basic question.
Right, right.
They ought to be able to tell you right away. And I think we will or we won't.
They have.
Okay, they have.
We told you.
We have. That's
they haven't started tagging them, though, have they?
No. They have. The answer is, to your question, Jane, if you had a judge that looked at the applicable law and the person or the body or the entity that was bringing cause against you signed a consent order that you could do it, well, guess what? You could park them in front of your house. And that's the issue.
Are you saying then that the public safety would not tag these trucks, even if we go ahead with a fence and so forth?
Yeah. I think...
You know, Mr. Mayor, the thing that really concerns me is I know we're talking about this.
I want to know, Pee Wee.
Not truly taking action on it, using it as leverage. But the thing that concerns me and scares me to death is if we use this as leverage and then Mr. Willing says, put the fence up. Then we're left. And he says, go ahead and put the fence up. I'm not going to do anything. Go ahead and put it up. And then we're stuck between the rock and hard place. And now we're going to live with the fence that the SCDOT decides to put in an entryway into our city. And who knows what it's going to be built out of, and who knows how tall it's going to be, and who knows
certainly
what it's going to look like.
Certainly can't look any worse than what's there now.
Councilman Wells, I need to clarify something, because I want to make sure I was not misunderstood. If Mr. Willing says, say, go ahead and put up the fence, I would go ahead and put up the fence. The fence itself has a tremendous amount of value. My only point was this, is that, and when I said leverage, and that is we need some tools in the toolbox to work this problem. We don't have them. That's what I said with respect to leverage. By all means, I think screening this junkyard would be a wonderful thing, regardless of the issue with the moving of the vehicles. I would like to get the moving of the vehicles in addition to that.
I think the frustration you're hearing is that we all agree with you in principle, but you're asking about a law that apparently has never been enforced, this junkyard, what did you call it?
Junkyard Control Act. The JCN.
That has never been used to enforce anything, so we would be the guinea pig for it, so to speak.
It's been used
many places. We asked the question earlier, and we had no example of where it's been used.
I think the question, if I recall...
If I misunderstood the...
No. I think it was... That was part of the question. The question had to do with circumstances like these, where you had an existing junkyard, rather than one that... for example, had a permit and then parked cars outside or wrecked vehicles outside the screening, one that was permitted. This is not a permitted junkyard because it was in existence prior to this act being passed. So I was answering the question with regard, I think Mr. Smith asked about a junkyard like this that pre-existed the implementation of the act.
What I understood Mr. Holly's answer to be was, right, apparently we have not had a pre-1966 right junkyard that was screened by a governmental entity.
Okay.
Enforced.
All right, so we agree. So that's one major issue. And number two, I think there might be support, but there won't be support unless we know how high the fence is, what it's going to look like, that kind of thing. And we ought to be able to move on that without a commitment of resources.
Right. I did say some time ago that knowing this is Aiken and the importance of appearances, rightly so, to our beautiful city and county, I asked that question, would they work with the city and county on the design? And they said, I was told by Mr. Brooker, they would. It would be a collaborative process on that. So I can't tell you what it's going to look like tonight, but I would think that you know, on funding. If it didn't look like the city and county wanted it to look like, they wouldn't fund it. So that question has been asked.
But they certainly would, I assume, know that it's got to be a certain height.
Right.
And it's going to be composed of certain material. I'm sure their standards are right. Are that defined.
Sure.
Maybe we couldn't see exactly what it would look like in the current environment, but we could get
right.
an idea.
But since the local governments are paying for it, I think there's a willingness to make it appear as the funding authorities would want it to look, as long as it accomplishes the purpose.
Who is Mr. Brooker?
He's an attorney for DOT. He's been there for 10 or 12 years.
Yeah,
more longer. He did not enter into this consent order. That was done well before his time. But he's been with them since early 90s, I think.
I'll tell you, I just cannot believe. I mean, if we're going to be spending $100,000 on something that's going to shield ugly stuff, I see places right in the city of Aiken where we could spend that money better than we could out there on that highway with this guy that can move those trucks in front of it every day if he feels like it.
Absolutely. Especially with no understanding of whether those movable cars can be come out there in front again.
Excuse me, and I haven't had dinner yet, so I'm not talking just to talk. I'll be glad to communicate with DOT legal staff, and if I could, with Mr. Smith and Mr. Pierce or whoever you tell me to, so that the information we receive is passed on, and they get to ask whatever questions they need to ask.
All right. How about a question to public safety as whether or not they would tag vehicles?
That was what I was talking. I said DOT. I should have said DOT and Department of Public Safety.
Okay, good.
Because they are separate agencies.
Because they haven't been doing it for years.
Right.
But all of a sudden they would start.
Well, I don't want to get into all the legal issues back and forth, because there's some things we might need to save for our toolbox rather than giving them up tonight.
Well, I don't want to dismiss your request, Scott, because I think you're addressing an issue we need to address. But I don't want to build a fence around. I don't want to reward him for junking up the entrance to Aiken with a $100,000 fence, to be blunt. I just like that idea. But I don't see why we can't pursue this, like you said, Gary, with a resolution to contact our legislators, to contact our governor, to contact the the branches of the government ought to help us with this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why we shouldn't at least start there. And
I agree. And the county council has gone down this road.
Yeah.
Has gone down with those discussions with those folks.
Well, let's quote them in the newspaper and tell who tells us we can't do anything.
It's fine. I mean, part of this also, I think, is even just a different way about going business between county and the city. County's not going to authorize that funding go out until staff has done its due diligence, come back to us, and provided us with all of the necessary materials, right? But we also recognize that, or at least that we need to actually show that county council is willing to do this. And I guess with Mr. Smith said, is this something y'all are willing to pursue if we can get everything, if we can get our I's dotted, our T's crossed, and get our issues and questions resolved? Because I sure as heck wouldn't want to have my staff spending a lot of time spinning its wheels doing a whole bunch of work if there wasn't the political will to do it. And I think that's all that was being asked for tonight.
Well, the chamber has in the past had this passion with June Murph, under June Murph,
oh,
as you
yeah.
recall, June
yeah.
got out there and done all of her due diligence there. But what is interesting, we thought we were coming up with a solution, and instead people have just kind of laughed at us in terms of planning the truck there, and we parked the truck in front of the planning that we got. And what I'm thinking about is we plant a fence and we build a fence and he parks the trucks in front of the fence, and we're bigger laughing stock invested $100,000. So I want to make sure the trucks are not going in front of the fence after we make this kind of investment.
I've got a sheet here that lists 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 complaints. And the first one started in December 16, 69. A complaint from Representative Grant to State Highway Engineer. And all these years. And that just goes down to 96. and then think what's happened in the not since 96, the next 12 years. So, notice of continued encroachment from construction engineer Kaufman to legal. Violation notice sent to B&W Inc. in 78. I mean, this is a frustrating thing. So we've got some questions to get answers to, as far as I'm concerned. What is public safety going to do with those things? That's a question. And I think we're pretty dumb to agree to something when we can't even get an answer out of our state public safety about what they would enforce and what they wouldn't.
I still believe the resolution we're talking about isn't doing it. It's talking about the possibility of doing it if we get the right answers.
Okay.
And we're going to have the resolution next meeting, I guess.
Okay, thank you, Gary, for putting something together.
Well, we may or may not. I mean, we're not going to have very many answers here by next meeting.
We need some answers.
We could put together a general resolution for you to look at.
Well, you know, it's which comes first, the chicken or the egg. I think what the county's looking, is the city interested in doing anything about it?
Absolutely, we're interested, but we also have to get the facts that we need to work with before we say, yeah, let's put some money behind it. Hey, we're in tough times here, you know, economically. People are going hungry, all kinds of stuff. We've got to be careful with the big money that we spend, as far as I'm concerned. That's my opinion. I don't care if we have the money, which we do.
But all he's asking for at this point, as I understand it, are we willing to join with the county to try to deal with this program, not committing money, not doing anything, just do we want to get involved in the process? It may fail, it may end, but do we want to get involved with the process?
Okay, I haven't heard those words, Dick, that you just said. All I see is this resolution, and they want to join with the city paying half of the $100,000. Now, Scott, is that exactly what you're saying? You want a piece of paper saying we are willing to see how this